All right. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, June 26, 2017. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening over another network or you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-475-3250, and our participant code is 449389. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save America. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right side of our website. Which, by the way, you know, we really do need money. We've just fallen way behind on bills, so if anybody that's not given could give $5 a month or more, we'd appreciate it. Okay, let's see. Tonight's scripture reading is going to be in Matthew chapter 10, verses 16 through 33. And by the way, I am coming through okay, right, Chad?
Yep, you're coming through fine.
Okay. All right, Matthew chapter 10, verses 16 through 33. Okay, behold, I send you forth as sheep in the midst of wolves. Be ye therefore wise as serpents and harmless as doves. But beware of men, for they deliver you up to the councils, and they will scourge you in their synagogues. And you shall be brought before governors and kings, and for my sake, for a testimony against them and the Gentiles. But when they deliver you up, take no thought how or what ye shall speak, for it shall be given you in that same hour what ye shall speak. For it is not ye that speak, but the Spirit of your Father that speaketh in you. And brother shall deliver up brother. Okay.
Okay.
I don't even know if we're being recorded or not at this point. And my froze up again. We're gonna have to find another venue. This just isn't working anymore. At least not for me. all right. Let's see. What is your recording showing that it's recording?
Yes, it does. Still? I can turn it on and turn it off.
Oh no, no, leave it on. Mine's saying recording now too. What about yours, Gerard?
Okay.
When it said it was off, it was set off. Also, mine. Jan said it was still recording, and mine said it was off. So. And then
okay, but is it on now?
Yes.
It's on now. All right, let's just go forward. We're going to have to call these people up tomorrow, but they don't really give you good, assistance on these kind of problems. But I don't know, maybe we'll find another venue. Yeah, I used to like that one we're at until we started to have problems on that one. I'm trying to think of the name of it. The recordings are stored right up there for you and everything. Do you remember the name of that one, Gerard?
Talkshoe,
yeah. That was pretty good because they had a lot of other rooms and people would come in just to see what your program is all about. So, all right, anyway, let's go forward. Let me see where I stopped. Okay, verse 21, I'll pick it up. And the brother shall deliver up brother to death, and the father the child, and the children shall rise up against their parents and cause them to be put to death. And ye shall be hated of all men for my name's sake, but he that endureth to the end shall be saved. But when they shall persecute you in the city, flee ye unto another. For truly I say unto you, ye shall not have gone over the cities of Israel till the Son of Man be come. The disciple is not above his master, nor the servant above the Lord. It is enough for the disciple to be as his master, and the servant as his Lord. If they have called the master of the house Beelzebub, how much more shall they call them of his household? Fear them not, therefore, for there is nothing covered that shall not be revealed and hid that shall not be known. What I tell you in the darkness, that speak ye in the light, and what ye hear in the ear, that preach ye on the housetops. And fear not them which kill the body, but are not able to kill the soul, but rather fear him which is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. All right, I'm going to stop there. Let me just read a couple of verses. And are not two sparrows sold for a farthing? and one of them shall not fall to the ground without your father. But the very hairs of your heads are all numbered. Fear ye not, therefore. Ye are no more value than many sparrows. Are ye not? Fear ye not, therefore. Ye are more of value than many sparrows. Whosoever, therefore, shall confess me before men, him will I confess also before my Father which is in heaven. But whosoever shall deny me before men, him also will I deny before my Father which is in heaven. All right, that was Matthew chapter 10, verses 16 through 33. Okay, I guess we're going to start off tonight. We're going to read a paper. It's an information paper that was sent to the president after we sent out the writ of error. The writ of error went out, of course, and then we copied numerous people. Maybe you could read who we all copied at the bottom of that, Gerard, before we start. But anyway, we copied a few congressmen, of course. We copied Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, and the information was the information to the president. And we attached, of course, the writ of error and the papers where that judge came in and tried to shut down our case. Therefore, he came and, you know, trespassed against on our case. Anyway, Gerard, you want to read the paper?
Yeah. Okay, so that was that copy was Jess Sessions, was Attorney General Sessions, Donald Trump, Senator Chuck Grassley, U.S. Representative Trey Gowdy, and U.S. Representative Jason Chavez. Okay, let me get back up to the top of the page, and I'll start reading here. And this is an information from the United States District Court for the Northern District, and it's the grand jury sovereigns of the court, against Governor A. Cuomo et al. Defendants, jurisdiction court of record under the rules of common law, and an action at law, case number 16CV-1490, and Magistrate Daniel Stewart, and it's titled Information/President. It is by and through our Constitution that we the people ordain that we have government by consent and establish common law, aka natural law, where the Creator gifted us with certain unalienable rights, thereby securing justice in our courts. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just power from the consent of the governed. That wherever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its power in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. And naturally, that's the Declaration of Independence. Further quoting, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote as the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our prosperity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. That's the preamble. It is through impartial juries that we the people consent to indictments, convictions, and remedy. Any jury instructed by judges is a tampered jury. Any grand jury driven by statutes is a puppet jury. Any jury not instructed in the power of nullification or forbidden to exercise the same exercises the will of the government and not justice. Now, quote, in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury, Amendment 6. No person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on a presentment or indictment of a grand jury, Amendment 5. The right of a trial by jury shall be preserved, and no fact tried by a jury shall be otherwise reexamined in any court of the United States than according to the rules of the common law, Amendment 7. The people of this state, as the successor of its former sovereign, are entitled to all rights which formerly belonged to the king by his prerogative. A consequence of this prerogative is the legal ubiquity of the king, his majesty in the eye of the law, written in the hearts. It is always present in all the courts. Though he cannot personally distribute the justice, his judges, juries, are the mirror by which the king's image is reflected. Without justice being freely, fully, and impartially administered, neither our persons, nor our rights, nor our property can be protected. And if these or either of them are regulated by no certain laws and are subject to no certain principles and are held by no certain tenure and are redressed when violated by no certain remedies, society fails of all its value, and men may as well return to a state of savage and barbarous independence. And that's Joseph Story, Commentaries on the Constitutions, 1833. Without liberty, the law loses its nature and its name, and it becomes oppressive. Without law, liberty also loses its nature and its name, and becomes licentiousness, driven by lust. James Wilson, of the Study of Law in the United States, around 1790. God's word declares, mercy, truth, and justice and judgment are the habitation of God's throne. The Lord is spirit, and where the spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. We are to stand fast in that liberty wherein God had made us free, and not be entangled again with the yoke of bondage. Justice, in the most extensive sense of the word, differs little from virtue, for it includes within itself the whole circle of virtues. Justice, being in itself a part of virtue, is confined to do things good or evil. Therefore, our courts are neither just or unjust. Juries can defend the poor and the fatherless, do justice to the affected, the afflicted, and the needy, deliver to the poor and the needy, and rid them out of the hand of the wicked. Decency, security, and liberty alike demand that government officials shall be subjected to the same rules of conduct that are the commands to the citizen. In a government of laws, existence of the government will be imperiled if it fails to observe the law scrupulously. Our government is the potent, omnipresent teacher. For good or for ill, it teaches the whole people by its example. Crime is contagious. If the government becomes a lawbreaker, it breeds contempt for the law. It invites every man to become a law unto himself. It invites anarchy. That's Olmsted versus the United States, 277 U.S. 438, 1928, Supreme Court case. Before any man can be considered as a member of civil society, he must be considered as a subject at the governor of the universe. It is the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God, to obey his will, and to be grateful for his benefits and humbly implore his protection and favor. We have no government armed with power capable of contending with human passions unbridled by morality and religion. Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to a government of any other. And that's a quote by John Adams. It is not that in any chain of human events the birthday of the nation is indissolubly linked with the birthday of a savior? That's a question. Is it not, in the chain of human events, the birthday of a nation indissolubly linked with the birthday of a Savior, that it forms a loading event in the progress of the gospel dispensation? Is it not that the Declaration of Independence first organized the social compact on the foundation of the Redeemer's mission upon earth, that it laid the cornerstone of human government upon the first precepts of Christianity? John Quincy Adams. I have lived a long time, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth, that God governs in the affairs of men. If a pharaoh cannot fall to the ground without his notice, it is probable that an empire can rise without his aid. We've been assured in the sacred writings that unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. I firmly believe this, and I also believe that without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel. Blessed is the nations whose God is the Lord. And that was Benjamin Franklin. America must stand on justice, not rogue judges. Judges may judge in equity cases, civil suits, and only when agreed to by both parties, if more than $20. In suits at common law where the value of controversy shall exceed $20, the right of trial by jury shall be preserved. And that's Amendment 7. whereas all criminal cases must be decided by the people, untainted and unshackled, judges are not to interfere. A great nation must be a just nation. A nation can only be as just as its courts. Whereas politically motivated judges whose rulings always favor the status quo and corporate America have seized control of our courts, true American patriots are imprisoned, tortured, and murdered. We the people have pleaded in the courts for more than 5 years to no avail. We have discovered that evil rules our American courts in the name of the people. Therefore, we the people have risen under the name of the sureties of the peace in the spirit of the Magna Carta and the Declaration of Independence as we near critical mass. We the people have opened an Article III Court of Record, which will proceed as a court of law. It is now incumbent upon you, Mr. President, to enforce the law of the land by demanding that Attorney General Jeff Sessions do his sworn duty and provide the only known Article III court in America with U.S. prosecutors who will exercise their sworn duty and let the people, jury, apply justice, because only the people can save America, without which America can never be great again. Justice must satisfy the appearance of justice. That's a quote. We the people are the rightful masters, both of Congress and the courts, not to overthrow the Constitution, but to overthrow the men who pervert the Constitution, Abraham Lincoln. If I know of no safe depository of the ultimate powers of society but the people themselves, if we think them not enlightened enough to exercise their control with a wholesome discretion, the remedy is not to take it from them, but to inform their discretion by education. This is the true corrective of abuses of constitutional power. Educate and inform the whole mass of the people. They are the only sure reliance for the preservation of our liberty. Dated June 22nd, signed by the grand jury foreman. Okay, that's the information.
Okay, that went out on Friday. Friday or Saturday. I think it was Friday. But anyway, they should be getting it today and tomorrow. Takes a while, I'm sure, for the president to get his mail. I'm sure they go through it and so on, but in any event. The key point to this whole thing is that it is an information to the president, really, at this point, for him to do his duty, and that is to obey the law and exercise the law. And, of course, that's what it basically says, which is what we're looking for, is for them to send prosecutors. Now, we did read the writ of error last week. I think that was pretty clear. That judge came in and violated at least three different statutes, I guess you'd call it. But the statutes were written for them, you know, for concealment. They have power and authority, and in order to control those people with power and authority, it is right that statutes are written to control these people that are in power and authority and to make certain kinds of a remedy or a penalty for an individual who abuses their authority and their powers. These judges, well, this judge here who has come in, he just came into the court. I mean, we have a judge that was chosen by a pool. All jurists are chosen by a pool. And by the way, a judge is a jurist, okay? But we didn't call upon this jurist nor this judge to come into this case. We called upon the people. But in any event, every court case gets either a magistrate, if it's a court of record, or a jurist, if it is a equity court where the judge is going to make a decision as a single jurist. Of course, there is an appeal process after that. You go in for a single judge. If you don't agree, you can appeal it, and you can appeal it up to numerous levels. But in any event, they are jurists, and they are chosen by pool. Our case up in New York was chosen. They chose a magistrate. We made it clear that we wanted a magistrate in this case, that the judge was going to play the role only of a magistrate. This particular magistrate is not a judge. He's just, period, a magistrate. His title does not hold the word judge, which, with my understanding, would mean he can't make a decision at all, even in an equity case. He operates solely as sort of a traffic cop. He keeps things moving in the court. But anyway, here we have a court case. We filed it in December. We're 7 months in. We've got hundreds of papers filed, and all of a sudden, out of left field, some judge who has not been appointed to this case through a pool process. just waltzes in, picks up the hammer of the sitting administrator and declares that this case is thrown out. Of course, we did a writ of error. There is no authority for the judge to do this. There's no precedent. Well, I guess there is a precedent because they do this all day long. When a judge is in a case and they're not willing to take that step beyond, and they, you know, as far as doing something illegal and violating their oath by serving the status quo, or when it's very obvious in the case itself, some judges will refuse to do that. And then often what happens is all of a sudden a new judge will show up in the case who's willing to do this, make the decision, and then leave the case. More often than not, if the case continues with other things, the original judge will continue to return. But he, again, if they refuse to make certain decisions, they'll just send another judge in. I don't know where they got this idea, but clearly lawyers don't debate it or argue it. They don't challenge it. We the people will challenge it. We have challenged it. We did challenge it. There is no statutory process that I'm aware of that permits this kind of a thing. Someone just to waltz into a courtroom, make a decision, and waltz out. We have a pretty powerful case with lots of paper. Clearly, the magistrate didn't want to make any decisions in this case, and clearly they had someone who was willing to do it. We did do a writ of error, and we did read that last week. I think it was a very powerful paper. I think we've covered all the bases on that paper. And, of course, now we're copying the President of the United States, and we're going to continue to file and continue to go forward in our case. We've got quite a bit of paperwork going through. We also are going to start filing affidavits. We've been making this known for maybe a month now that anybody who has a story to tell that would like to get their affidavit into our case, which would make it an active part of our case, by the way, you know. So if you have a situation where you were abused by the courts, unlawfully imprisoned, abused in prison, charged with criminal statutes and facing time in prison, anything of those natures, you could write a affidavit, get into the court. At some point in time, each and every single one of those affidavits have to be dealt with and answered to. And again, you know, anybody can send us an affidavit. We do have a process. If you have an affidavit you'd like to put in, you send it to affidavits. I believe that's plural. I'll have to double check that in a minute.
Yes, it is.
It is plural? Okay. Right. Affidavits at nationallibertyalliance.org. Okay. Well, don't go out and have your affidavit notarized or anything yet. You want to send in, you know, your story in an affidavit form. We want to check it out and make sure it passes what's necessary to get into this case. We don't want 100 pages or 30 pages or 20 pages or 5 pages. 1 to 3 pages should be sufficient. We want people just to tell their story, just the facts, nothing else. We don't want people to quote, the Constitution or try their case in any way in the affidavit. That's not what an affidavit is for. We don't want anyone to use the magical words of, you know, the man on the land and all that stuff, the family of someone or whatever. That's only playing into their evil process that they've set up. But in any event, we just want story to be told. This is, you know, you say who you are, and this is what's happened to me, and this is what happened next. Just tell the facts to get your story or your case into the larger case. Of course, all of these affidavits collectively assist and help to prove all of the abuse by the courts and the prison process, you know, the prisons. And also, again, like I said, at some point in time, each and every one of these affidavits have to be addressed, and justice needs to be met on them. So they themselves will spur off into cases. You know, they've sent, I think I heard it was something like 450 lawyers that were put on the case to go out after this Russian thing where there's supposed to be some interference by Russia in the election process here. 450 lawyers going through papers and and evaluating and looking for a crime, you know. Well, they should send those 450 lawyers to us. They won't have to look for the crime. They could just start prosecuting because we've already got all the information. I'm sure they can get more. But if they could afford to do that, I'm sure they can afford, more importantly, to deal with the abuse upon we, the people, in our courts and in our prisons. So anyway, again, if anybody wants to put an affidavit in, fine. We also, of course, and we've been talking about this for a while, taking anybody who's gone through a process with foreclosures or in the process of a foreclosure, whether it's a tax foreclosure or a mortgage foreclosure, you know, we also are putting those cases into our case. They must be heard at some point in time. We're doing show causes here. And again, this shows the illegal, unconstitutional process that they're using. They're doing what's called a non-judicial foreclosure. Go figure that out. Just think about those words, a non-judicial foreclosure. In other words, we're just going to come and take your property, period. And that, of course, violates due process rights, Fifth Amendment. It just goes on and on and on. So anyway, we do have some that are coming near to, let me see, yeah, I don't know the exact dates that we started putting them in, but I believe we do have some that's coming up to the point where they're going to default. They can't answer these papers, so they will default. And that in itself, with the wherefore clause, requires, and the court will put a court order out on it, or is required to do that, and command these individuals, the judge, the mortgage company, or the tax process there in that county or whatever, ordering them to return this person back to the original state. That's the remedy before all this started. If people want to sue these people further, of course, that win will help them, and they can take that and try to sue further. But our concern is to help people save their homes or get their homes back, and in places where it's an impossibility to get your homes back, and I'm sure some of those situations could be. I would imagine, you know what, even if someone bought your home, then those people are going to be injured too, and they're going to have to be paid, recompense. They're going to have to restore those individuals as much as they're going to have to restore the individual whose home they were taken. But if someone else has bought the home and the person is willing to accept the value, then move on, and that's their business. Point is, though, people must be restored. And that's what this whole court case is about. Our real focus on our court cases is to bring people into power, get the common law grand juries process going back and the trial juries back up and going, get the people to control that in their local courts in every county across America, to take control, to make sure that honor, justice, and mercy is applied from everybody involved in this judicial process, with an eye and a focus constantly on restoring the injured party. And also, of course, to prevent all this abuse, people being imprisoned for violating statutes. Again, we the people never gave the government any authority to control our behavior through statutes. Statutes are only law when they're constitutional. Let me repeat that. Statutes are only law when they're constitutional. That means where we clearly told them, you have the power and the authority to create statutes here, there, and wherever else. Okay, let's see. So we're taking affidavits, and we're doing the foreclosures. I'd like to get back to, to the other papers that we're filing, habeas corpuses. We do have 30 of them. And I think we're gonna try to work on it in the next couple of weeks. Probably start this week, and it'll take a couple of weeks to put together. But we have 30 of them that were ignored, and we're gonna do show causes on those judges that ignored them, that concealed the papers, prevented them, destroyed them, removed them, prevented them from being filed, whatever it is that they did. Okay. Because it hadn't been heard in the court, and they just ignored it. They didn't obey the court process. Well, now we're going to enforce that to show causes and start going after these judges. Very, very soon, I think we're going to come together to discuss numerous indictments. So we're going to call for a meeting soon. anybody who would like to come and hear the cases and put in a vote for an individual to be indicted or not. I think we're going to do that very soon. Whether when we reveal the indictment in the courts, that's going to be another thing. We might wait a little longer. We might want to see how certain things go before we start putting in indictments. And of course, that's the main reason why we opened this case, you know, because they refused to do the just thing. They refused to obey the Constitution, have Article III courts, and to enforce justice. So we, the people, took it upon ourselves, which is our unalienable right, to open up a court of record, to press for a magistrate, to come in as the name of the people. We came in as the sureties of the peace. After all, they can't come in, we the people. They come in with the cases, the people versus Joe Schmo or whatever. On federal cases, it's the United States versus whoever, John Doe, you know, Mary Doe, whatever it is. Okay, so in our good name, they come and they assault and abuse people, claiming that they've committed crimes that they have not committed, broken laws that they have not broken, or terrorists when in fact they are patriots. And so we have every right to push this court case to open and force this illegal, unconstitutional judiciary and force a common law process. We're looking for prosecutors that they need to supply. Of course, that's why we're going after Jeff Sessions, to have him supply us with U.S. prosecutors. I'd like to see about 450 of them down there. I think we have so much work, 450 lawyers won't be enough. 450 prosecutors won't be enough. But in any event, that's where we're heading.
Drain the swamp.
Yeah, drain the swamp. But in any event, that's what we're doing. We may start the indictment process, but seal the indictments until we're ready to file them in the courts. So
you know what I was thinking on the indictments, John? I mean, I know we've done it with the writ of error somewhat, but I think on the indictments we should be very specific. Like in this case that we just gave the writ of error for, you know, this judge went out and did a bunch of stuff, didn't think twice about it. But each thing that he did, he admitted to a crime, and I think we should enumerate it. Number one, he said, I've been asked to look at. Well, that was an ex parte conversation. That's a crime, right? And then and then he brought up the clerk, into it. Wasn't even his case, but he knows about it. So that proves that he had knowledge of the clerk and the default. So he's hung his hat on that thing also. So he needs to be indicted for that one too, right? Because he's in there.
Well, absolutely, yes. You know,
right? So he admitted to that. Plus he's coming in trespassing on the case. So I don't know. But each thing that he did, you know, to us is a charge that a grand jury would bring a charge to. And I think we should enumerate it, because let them know that we're counting their transgressions. And they're going to have to answer for each one of them. I think it's very powerful to see those things in a list and get him thinking about every time he makes a move. We're going to write down what he does, and we're going to charge him when he makes the wrong move. And I think you'll see more respect from them about what, you know, they'll be more, have more trepidation about doing stuff if they think that we're going to enumerate it, document it, and stick it in the case. And they're going to realize who they're messing with here. So we should discuss, you know, getting very specific with our charges when we do indict them, you know?
Well, absolutely. We need to list it out and then, you know, put it out for all of the potential grand jurists to consider and make a vote on. We should start that soon, because we've got about three or four or maybe even five that we can do almost right away. And I don't want to build them up where we have 30, 40, 50 of them. You know, we have a whole bunch of show causes that I know they're going to violate, and unless they free these people and restore these people to their original state of being and obey the wherefore clause on that default, when they default on those show causes, if they don't do that, then we need to bring them up for consideration of indictment also. And it'll be pretty much the same thing on all the, there's about 30 cases, they're all of the same thing, concealment, ignoring due process, denying due process, you know, just violating all kinds of different things. And we will list them out. But I think we'll be able to do like 30 of them almost in a row, because they'll be pretty much, they all violate the same law. They all got the same story. People will be able to look at the evidence, and then we'll be able to get through them quite quickly. But we do have a lot to look at. And I don't think we should wait until we get one indictment to go through before we start going through that indictment process, because then we may have 100 indictments, and it's just going to take a lot of time and a lot of our time to do that. Where we can start the process maybe in a couple of weeks and keep the indictments sealed until we're ready to file them in the courts. But at least when we're ready to file them in the courts, we can put a whole bunch of them in one shot. Once one goes through, we'll pile them up right behind the rest of them.
That's part of our strategy.
But we are looking to potentially, if it's necessary, we're going to indict also the magistrate who has been ordered already on two cases to sign the default papers. He has no choice. He must do it. He just can't ignore it. He's got to do it. But of course, he's been quiet. He's not doing anything. I think he was praying and hoping that this judge can come in, fix it, and close everything down, and he doesn't have to worry about it no more. Well, that's not the case. We're going to do, I haven't figured out how many days it's been since we've given him the orders, but we're going to give him only 30 days, and then after that, then we're going to do, you know, show cause by what authority he thinks he does not act, you know. And, of course, he's not going to be able to answer that, and then he will be considered for an indictment. And maybe he will be our first indictment, because by putting his name in as an indictment, we'll remove him and tell him to get us another individual. I think there is precedent in the common law process for a sheriff to take over or something of that nature. I'd like to see someone like that take over. There is a murder case in here, so... You know, again, even the coroner could take over to some degree as the administrator of the court, I'd imagine. I'm not sure exactly how that would work. We'll talk with Brent. Maybe Brent could comment on that, because he would know better than I would from reading his book how these courts' processes actually worked many, many years ago. But in any event, if we have to, we'll remove this administrator and put another one in and order that individual to sign the papers.
You know what's funny? The fact that we put in the clerk paperwork and they let it lapse. They let it go defaulted, and they didn't say anything. And then mm-hmm. we put in the default, and they still didn't say anything. And then out of left field, they get this judge to trespass on the case and throw the whole thing out. I mean, why did they let it default in the first place? I mean, it's very hard. First of all, once you let something default, you have to bring great proof of why you defaulted it, which they have done. They're the government. The government should never default. They have no excuse unless the whole state blew up. They had some kind of volcano that took over the whole state. That's not what happened. We know nothing like that happened. So there's no reason for this. They should have answered us. They should have at least kicked us out of court. What's so hard? They're used to doing it. Why didn't they kick us out right in the beginning? Instead, they let us default, right, send a notice of default in, get this other thing going, and then come in and try to throw everything out, the baby with the bathwater and everything, and never answer, not even the first thing. They're in a bad – I'll tell you what. They're in a bad situation right here. Think about it. Because like it said before in that paper, if the government is lawlessness, you certainly can't expect the people to hold a higher standard. They're supposed to be the law that we created, right? And if they're not going to obey the law, you think we're going to? You know, that's what starts revolutions. The fact that they ignore you and they default you, and there's a whole process and a whole procedure about trying to overcome a default. And you know what? It's almost impossible for them to do, because there's two or three different things that they have to prove in order
yeah,
to...
There's two
in
of
order
them,
to,
believe, yeah.
Right, two of them, right. In other words, they have to show that they had a good reason. And they also, and even if they had a good reason, they have to show that they probably would have won to begin with, I think it is, isn't John?
Right, those are the two things, exactly.
Right. So how are they going to do that? And they they obviously, they have to know this, but of course they're probably not used to people defaulting them, but they sat there and they let these things default. So they put a big black mark on them. And that's what we got to hammer on. Who do you think you are that you could sit there and not answer us? Look, we know you know how to throw us out. The first time we didn't put a summons in, we didn't. The ink wasn't dry on the paper, and we got home, and the paper was there that they threw it. You didn't have a summons. We threw the case out. Remember, John?
Mm-hmm.
It didn't take them 5 minutes to do that. So here you have a case that's been in court since December, right? And then they come in now in June and throw it out and lump the first case and the second case all together and throw it out. That's really arrogant, and that's really, it's stupid in a sense. It really shows their lawlessness, that they have no regard for the people. So, and the first thing too is when we first put the paper in, then they answered when they didn't even need to answer, and they asked for more time, and we
and
had
they
an
answered
answer
through a letter. They didn't even answer. They wrote a letter to the judge.
Yeah, they wrote a letter. So right off the bat, they're not following any kind of rules of courts or procedures or anything. Then he comes back and says, I've been asked to look at this. Well, asked by who? Where's the motion? How come we didn't know? And they did this to us also in the committee man case, right, John? All this ex parte stuff back and forth. So they have a real bad habit of doing this. They're not following court procedure and law, and that's why we have to come in. Like Brent says, the only cure for lawlessness is the law, and we got to put that. We got to put that up there, and we got to and we got to reveal to people that these are basic principles of law that you can't let them get away with. Because if they get away with that, you don't have a prayer at anything else. If you're going to start off right off the bat wrong, how could you go ahead, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's like going into a rehab with your needles and your rubber band and your drugs, right? How do you start when you have no intention of continuing on a certain path to accomplish the thing at hand? So right away they start off violating you. It proves that they have no intention of hearing you, and that's why we got to bring these things right up to the forefront, because these issues are just as important, if not more important, than the whole case is. Because the reason these cases are going the way they're going is because they're not holding to the fundamental principles and the rules of the court. They're bending the rules. They're I don't want to say nothing, but it's like playing pool with certain people that like to change rules in the middle of the case. You don't know where it's coming from, right? It's like, why? Because we decided on it. I mean, what's up with that? You know, what's the point of having rules of the court if you're not gonna stick to them? Oh, but God forbid you should violate a rule of the court. They're very quick to throw you out for it, to default you for it, right? But anyway, I'm done.
Okay. All right. Let's see. We're also looking for help. If everybody that's out there should be helping one way or another. And we would expect everyone to help by donating $5 a month or more, which we seriously in need of money. So anybody who's not helping, please consider helping. But also everybody should be, you know, giving us an hour a week of their time. Join a committee. Get involved. Even if you're involved on your local side, building committees of safety. I mean, that's fine. Let's just do it. You should also take on the role of a county organizer or a state organizer. If you're building a committees of safety, you should take on the role as county organizers with us, because that role, or that title, so to speak, could assist in the building up of your committees of safety, of course. But also it'll help to fortify National Liberty Alliance and get more people involved in what we're doing here on the national level, as much as they need to be getting involved on the local level. And, of course, we're looking to build administrations in every single county, 3,100 and whatever counties there are. I constantly forget. In any event, we need people involved in every county to become administrators. Four administrators we need in every single county, and those are the people who will deal on behalf of the people with the grand jury and the trial jury, make sure that they are not tainted, you know, by the judge or by a prosecutor. And also, and as I mentioned, the grassroots, building the committees of safety. Right now, we really need help with people helping to process affidavits. So anybody who can volunteer an hour or more a week, you know, let's say even you could say, well, I can look at one affidavit a week. Where, you know, we'll give you sort of give you some basic training on what it is we're looking for in an affidavit. And it's very simple, just the facts. We don't want any of this language with the man on the land stuff in it. We don't want people trying their case in an affidavit. We don't want them to quote, you know, the Constitution and this is what they've done to me on this or that. We just want people to tell the story. That's all that we want, you know, exactly as it is, as you would tell your neighbor. You know, and get it down on paper and get it in. So that's we'll train the people to show them what we're looking for, and help them. You can help us process these affidavits. Once they go through you, they go through a series of approvals before we put it into the case. We don't want to refuse anyone. There might be some we might refuse in the beginning to put it in, but we'll let them know we'll hold it to put them in a little later. You know, so but. But we are looking for specific cases where people are abused. It makes the point clear that the judicial process is just totally corrupt. The prison process, or whatever you want to call that, is totally corrupt. It's all about money, and it's about abuse. And we want to make our case. We want to help to get people out of jail. We want to help people to get justice and so on. Okay. Are there any questions? Jan?
Yes, I have two questions tonight. First question, would a Japanese individual living in one of the states of the Union have constitutional rights?
Well, look, there is no real thing as constitutional rights. We have unalienable rights. Unalienable rights come from God, and if it's given to anybody that's of German descent or Irish descent, or whether you want to call yourself an American or Japanese, or it doesn't matter. If you're a human being, you have unalienable rights. That's it. End of subject. There's nothing to talk about. Can't deny them.
Okay. Second question. What must an individual do, and or what are the steps he, she must take to become a sovereign citizen in the United States?
Well, you're born sovereign. You know, look, at I don't shy away from that word citizen. You know, I know there's a lot of people who make a case out there, you know, being a sovereign citizen is sort of, you know, an oxymoron. Our founding fathers had no problem using the word citizen. It is true. I know Brent has made a case concerning the, you know, citizen and the city, that kind of thing. I don't know if after I'm done with this, maybe Brent might want to comment on this. But here's the key thing. It doesn't matter what you call yourself. You're a human being with unalienable rights, and you can't lose them, period. They can't make some magic word or label for an individual that therefore they think that they are justified in denying someone's unalienable rights. Look at it in the Constitution itself. It is on a federal level where citizens are the people come from another nation, come into our country, and they go through become a citizen. That process has been given to the federal level. So that's what they deal with. And you know, we are citizens of the state we're in, and we're all U.S. citizens. And the reason why we're all U.S. citizens ultimately is because we have our unalienable rights protected in every single state of the Union. You know, you can pack your bags tonight and move five states away, be there the following morning, and you don't have to file papers. You are a citizen of that state. If that's what you want to be, you have the protection of that state, the right of justice in that state, and the court systems and so on. And the next day you could decide to go to another state. You know, we can go from state to state to state, and we get all of our rights. And that's why I think the idea of being referred to as a U.S. citizen. But, you know, we may call ourselves a citizen of New York, born, or whatever you want to say, however you want to put it, but, you know, you're a citizen of New York, but you are also a U.S. citizen. If we play into their game with words, then we're empowering them and playing into their fraud. Look, it's a fraud. That's it. It's evil. It's wrong. And anybody trying to apply these things to divide we the people, to enslave we the people, those people need to be arrested, tried, and whatever needs to be done with them, whatever the common law might say. Which is really what the jury would decide, whatever penalty that the jury really wants to place on that. Every case is unique, you know, so you can't, one judgment can't fit all. Every single case, no matter how much they may be of the same type of case, you know, intent, the people, characters, there's a difference in every case. So there can be nothing written straight out, this is how we deal with it. But, in any event, you know, the law must be applied. And being a citizen doesn't hurt your unalienable rights.
Hopefully
I got that.
Look, there's another thing that causes a lot of confusion, and it's a game they play. And I hate giving them credibility for anything that they want to, you know, try to play a game with. But when they ask you, like on a driver's license, are you a U.S. citizen? And, of course, we say, yes, I'm a United States citizen, yeah. But, you know, then there's the question, well, are they talking about a resident of the District of Columbia? And so they're treating you as a resident of District Columbia, which means as a resident of the District of Columbia, they think that you go by a different set of rules, not under the Constitution. Now, I don't know if that helps them sleep at night, but there was a judge recently that came out and said, look, that doesn't work. He said, because I can have a contract or a license or anything else in any other state, and that doesn't make me a resident of that state. So he blew them right out of the water right there, because what's the requirement for a residency? It's where you lay your head at night, isn't it? So, see, they're playing stupid games, and they don't even realize how stupid they are. But, you know, if you're going to get hung up on all that stuff, you won't take step one. The fact of the matter is you go in, like John says, and you rest on your unalienable rights. You were born here, you lived here, and you those rights are yours through God, not anybody.
And you could be born anywhere on the planet. It doesn't matter. You know, you come to the United States, even if you're not a citizen, but you're visiting here, you have unalienable rights here as much as I do, you do, or anybody else does.
Yeah, that's another thing. Oh, should we give this illegal guy unalienable right? Well, no, let's just go Sharia law. Let's cut his head off and let's not give him a trial because he's not a United States citizen. I mean, that's ridiculous. All men are created equal. It doesn't say anything other than that, right? So, anyway, that's people get confused with all that. And the other thing is it's about consent too. They like to get you consenting to stuff without you realizing it. They like to get you contracting to stuff without you realizing it. And you have to smarten up before you sign any document or anything else. That's how the IRS works. The IRS gets you to consent in. You don't even realize you're doing it, you know. And so they're hanging you with the information that you're giving them and the signatures you're giving them is what's hanging you. I mean, there's a lawyer out there. He'll help you with the IRS, but he says only if you're not them. Only if you're not that person. If you're not putting in W-2s and 1099s. He said, I can't help you if you're putting in W-2s and 1099s because what you're saying is I owe this and I agree to pay it and I agree to all the penalties that come with not paying it. So, you know, as long as you're working and you're not sending in 1099s and W-2s, he'll go to the Supreme Court for you. You see, but we've all, like John says, it's all fraud. They didn't tell us when we signed that pay. You go get a job, the employer doesn't say, you can fill out the W-2 or not. And the truth of the matter is if you don't fill it out, they cannot not hire you. They just have to put an affidavit in there that says that they asked you and you refused. And there's a case of a fellow from Mexico came over here and went to work for Taco Bell. And he never had a Social Security number or anything. And eventually they liked him. He worked good and they wanted to make him a manager. They're going to send him to manager school. And all of a sudden, they realized that they didn't have a valid Social Security number for him. And so then they fired him. And he took him to court, got a lawyer and took him to court because he refused to fill the W-2 out and the Social Security number. And he won a year's salary because the lawyer took – and the IRS said they, – you know, they had the IRS on the stand. They subpoenaed the IRS to court, and the IRS said, we just told you to ask him. We didn't tell you you had to fire him if he didn't have it. They didn't help the employer at all. So he won a year's salary as his wherefore clause, because the fact of the matter is, you know, they're operating under some other type of thing. It's certainly not under the Constitution, but it's under an adhesion contract or whatever. You're supplying them with information that they're going to hold to you. You know, you go to the military and you sign your name on that line. Guess what? They own you for that period. So there are certain things that you can give away to the government that they can hold you to. Certain unalienable rights, like, you know, when they say you better be over here, guess what? You don't have the freedom to not be there because you contracted under a military contract. And guess what? You lost some inalienable rights by giving that signature. So think about everything you're signing and everything you're doing, that's all. Think about consent. You know, I mean, the thing that – I don't know if you guys – everybody's got phones and smartphones and all these apps they give you. Do you ever read the terms of agreement on those apps? My God, you have to be crazy to hit the thing that say, I agree. We can use your phone and this and that and this and that and this and you can't sue and we can take you here and there. I mean, read that stuff. It's like you're less than a slave by the time you put that app on your stupid phone. You know, and they can use all that information for whatever they want. You have no control. One thing. Okay, I'm done,
hey,
John.
You know, just to go back just a little bit, you might have made a mistake here in this idea of residence, or we didn't bring it up, but it is also domiciled. And they like to make everybody a resident because a resident really means someone in transit. You know, you're only here for a temporary period of time, and then you're moving on. And therein, they're trying to keep you out of the state, and they're really trying to move your domicile into the District of Columbia, where they claim to play all this magic and all of this fraud. Hey, remember, this is all fraud. It doesn't matter whether you – first of all, they're not going to bring up the meanings of these things in order to trap you. They're just there to make them feel better that they think that they're protected, you know. But the bottom line is when you go up against their conclusion and make the point clear that this is nothing but fraud, and they're playing just a game on words, a game on phrases, in order to trap you somewhere. And remember, you know, you can't sign away your rights, your unalienable rights. They can't be transferred. They can't be sold or transferred. That's what makes them unalienable. Again, it's just a game they play. We don't want to play in their sandbox. We're bringing them into the sandbox of justice. And we're just going to call it for what it is. It's all a fraud. It has no power, no authority. It's null and void. Any statute, any law, anything written by Congress that is repugnant to the Constitution, ultimately not just to the list of powers that they have, and they've gone outside that authority, but anything that violates our unalienable rights. The Bill of Rights particularly lays out the basic standard, but in any event, it's all null and void. It's repugnant. It's null and void. It has no power, no authority. It's as if it'd never been passed. Okay. Let's see about moving on here. Any other questions, Jan?
No, that was the last question. I think Robert B. has some announcements tonight.
Okay, go right ahead.
Okay, well, I just found something that might be of interest to people, and that is today the Supreme Court, according to Vice President Pence, reinstated Trump's travel ban.
Oh, that's good news. When did you hear this?
Wait. What business does the Supreme Court have?
No, the United States Supreme Court has every right and authority to come in and kick the butt of these federal courts that they can make it up.
In other words, they lower court. I got you.
They've done their job. They've done what they should have done a long time ago anyway. They should have been involved earlier, but better late than never. Right, Robert?
That's right. It was done this morning. And I just got the tweet from Vice President. And,
oh, that's great news. Okay.
Yep. Okay, and the next thing, I really don't have any news on the Western Front except for the fact that we're coming up on July now, and that means they're fixing to fire up the courts in Nevada again and have another trial. So that's coming up here soon. So
hey,
we'll
Robert,
start having
maybe,
news.
Maybe you can go through the list. If you don't have this list, Jan will get it for you, or I'll find it for you. Of all the individuals we did habeas corpus for out there in Nevada, and we also did the same thing with all these individuals out there in Oregon, if you can, I don't know if you got anybody out there that can go through this list and see who we're missing. I do know we're missing a guy from, I think, from Massachusetts. We didn't get him in. We probably should do another habeas corpus to get those individuals in, and those will be the first habeas corpuses we'll do the show courses on them, by what authority these people are acting or you know, not acting, really. They are concealing or removing, destroying, but clearly they're not obeying their oath in the Constitution.
So. Well, I'll need the list then.
Yeah, Jan, do you have a copy? Well, you should be able to get the copy right offline. I think if you go up onto line, you'll see the habeas corpuses we have up there. I think we have them all up there. You could just click on them, and anybody whose name's not on that list that is in these trials, maybe you can find someone to help you on this, and let's get those names so we can get habeas corpus on those people, too.
All right.
But go right ahead.
Okay, we have the courtroom observers call on Wednesday night, and everyone who's interested in being a courtroom observer should come on in 9 p.m. Eastern on Wednesday night, and we'll be talking about how to be an efficient and a better courtroom observer, and hopefully we can get some professional people out of all this. We'll get everybody trained up on how to do it and get more people involved. And on Thursday night we have two calls. First one is natural healing. We have a professional herbalist teaching this, and we had our first call last week. I think it was excellent, and I look forward to another great call on Thursday night, and that's at 8 p.m. Eastern on Thursday night. And then following that, we have the COS call at 9 p.m. Eastern. And we're having some nice, excellent calls and teaching going on there too. And anybody that's involved with setting up COSs need to come on in and listen to our speakers. So Wednesday and Thursday night, right now I'm pushing hard. So hopefully I see more of you there. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Robert. Anyone else, Jan?
No, that was that it for tonight.
Okay. All right, let's see what we have left here. All right, what I'm going to do is I'm going to bring on Brent. Brent, maybe in the beginning, if you want to make any comment, I'm kind of interested in your thoughts and ideas concerning someone other than a judge taking control of the administration of a court in a court of record, one that's where there's a jury. Maybe you can comment a little bit on that in history or whatever you might want to say on that. There was something else that came up you might want to comment. I forget what it was, but if you remember. But anyway, let me introduce Brent. Brent Winters is the author of Excellence in Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com. And with that, I'm going to pass it over to Brent. And Gerard, you going to take the control of the panel here? Gerard.
Yep.
All right, yep. I'm going to move to another computer, but I'll be participating, but you keep the panel. Brent, are you here with us?
Yes. Can you hear me? If you can, I'll keep talking.
We got you.
Oh, good. This is Brent. Brent Allen Winters. I told my mother today, my mother named me, or my father too, I suppose, but I didn't use my middle name most of my life. Finally, that why I didn't use it. And so ago, I began to use it. My mother, I talked to her today. She approved. She liked the name, so she was happy I did that. That's the distinguished that are also on the Internet who are divergent from me in their point of view, so much so it's abhorrent. So it's better that I call myself Brent Allen Winters and not Brent Winters. They don't confuse me with some of these unusual people out there that are on the Internet. But my name is Brent Allen Winters, commonlawyer.com. All experts on the only way about us sucking us into the vortex of sewer. The only remedy is law. There is no other remedy. You can take and try to destroy all the people that are troubling us, that are interested in law, and it wouldn't change things any until you know law, until we know law ourselves. Someone mentioned, I don't remember the trigger this time. Mind will go listening to the talk.
Yeah, Brent, you're cutting in and out pretty bad.
Well, that's telling me. I'll move my phone. That's too. Now, I hope it's better. Hang on just a minute
that's
while
better.
I adjust. Is that better? Good. Thanks.
Much
for telling
better.
Me. And then, anyway, why do people go to war? Well, the courts. Here's what it was. Somebody said something about the courts not paying attention to the law. Why do people fight? Why do people go to war? There's only one reason why people go to war, have disagreements, and that is that they cannot agree upon an external standard whereby to govern their relationship. We did not agree on an external standard between us and Japan, and so we ended up killing each other. There is no other remedy, by the way, when it comes to nations. If the world's wide enough, we can live apart and not fight. But if it isn't wide enough and there is an interaction between us, and what, for example, Japan decided that was right for them to do, namely plunder, rape, murder, pillage the Chinese, plunder, rape, murder, pillage the Romanians, plunder, rape, murder, pillage the Filipinos, plunder, rape, murder, and pillage Americans, or any combination of those, they said that their God, their lawgiver, said that that's what they must do. They must pull, they said. They must pull all of the world under the, not four, but nine corners. That's the way they saw the world, and still do, by the way. We have four corners in our thinking. They have nine. We must pull the whole world under the nine corners of our God. And who was their God? Well, it was the man who lived among them, who was 128 generations descended, they said, from the sun, the heavenly body itself, just like the pharaohs of Egypt, just like the emperors of Babylon, just like the emperors of Pergamos, just like the emperors of Rome, the same old filthy, ugly manure turned over again, rotten on the bottom. They turned it up and did it again. And Hitler did the same thing. He just knew he couldn't politically get away with it, calling himself a god, like the Japanese called their mere mortal of a man. But in all of those cases, whether it was because of the Christian sensibilities in Germany, but they gave him the same powers, that the powers of a god, the powers of godhood, and he followed Hegel, the German philosopher, who said that the state is God in the place of God, not God, in the place of God on earth. All of that kind of silly, well, I guess it wouldn't be so devastating. It is silly, but it's so murderous in a mass way to take that position. Well, we couldn't agree on an external standard. We said fundamentally a critical mass of people in our country believe that our God doesn't allow that. Our God doesn't demand that we eat the other fellow. Our God says that we're supposed to love the other fellow. And God gives us a set of standards whereby we love the other fellow. Do not covet, lie, steal, commit adultery, or murder your neighbor. The last five of the Ten Commandments govern our relationship with horizontally with other men. So we couldn't live with them because they were trying, so we went to war. And that's why men go to war today. Well, that brings us to another subject. Related, though, I'm talking about the processes in the courts today, in our common law courts, not in the courts of the law of the city, which governs almost the whole world, that same old putrid Code of Justinian, and Japan had taken over the Code of Justinian. That's why they were able to justify what they did in a big way. They took over the German Code of Bismarck, and German and Japan were allies back in the Russian-Japanese War. Well, Germany didn't declare it to be true, but they were the ones that were helping arm Japan during those days. But they took on the same code of the city, the Code of Babylon, which says that the government has the powers of God. And that's why Hitler did what he did. But in a common law country like our country, we say, and I think Gerard read this at the beginning, reading, by the way, from the commentaries of Justice Joseph Story, his commentaries on the Constitution. And if you don't have a copy of those, you can get them, by the way, in the abridged form. One single volume covers the whole United States Constitution. And you can look up there what he believed as a proponent of our common law, what he believed the Constitution meant by what it says. It's significant, his commentaries, for this reason. And there are many good commentaries out there. A fellow by the name of Tucker wrote a good set of commentaries on the Constitution. And, of course, slipped my mind, the other fellow. But at any rate, there are more than one. But Story's is significant for this reason. Because Story's commentaries were written right at 39, 40 years of shakedown of the Constitution. You know, we had it, then we had to use it to see what we would believe it meant and how it would be applied. That's what I'm really saying. How do you apply these things? Our Constitution doesn't say how it is to be applied, and it takes the wisdom, the discernment of men to do that, and that's where our courts come in to give their word on the matter. That doesn't mean it's the final word. The executive department gives its word and decides what it is going to do. And we've seen that happen. D.J. Trump decided what he was going to do. But it's nice to have the courts weigh in on the matter. And that's why we have courts. That's why these men wear black robes. They didn't used to wear black robes. They used to be very colorful, like the robes in England. But when William and Mary passed away, the judges in England, back before our country started, donned black robes in mourning for the death of the ending of the reign of William and Mary. And that tradition followed us into America because we never did get over the death of William and Mary. That was the idea. That's why we still wear black robes. But who knows that? And we've all forgotten that now. That's what happens. We try to make symbols to remember. But William and Mary were important to us because they were Protestant kings of England, and they were invited, not they weren't hereditary, they were invited to come and serve in that position. That's, again, consistent with our common law, executive power by invitation, not by heredity. Well, the courts, the procedures in the courts, here's the reason I brought that up, about battle. When we can't agree in America with our neighbor or somebody here in the States, one of our fellow Americans, about whether or not we've been wronged or they've been wronged, or we get into a dispute and there's a bloody plaintiff, somebody really injured, we agree, when we go to court, we agree on a common external standard, external to both of us, an objective standard, whereby to govern our relationship. And we say that standard is the law as we have it now in our own country. Our Constitution is an important part of that. And then we go to court. And although we say we agree on the law, we don't agree on maybe how it should be applied in a particular instance. And so we give it to the jury. In the best case scenario, And we say we're going to impanel 12 people on the spot so they don't have time to be bribed, and we're going to ask them what happened in the past. What are the facts? And then we're going to ask them to apply the law to those facts and give us a verdict. That's what we ask them to do. And our trials in America are truly trials. They are battles. We call it battle by trial before the jury. Again, the rest of the world, under the Roman law, the Code of Justinian in its various forms, do not have trials. In France, Germany, South America, Central America, Mexico, Vietnam, Japan, Germany, Norway, all the rest of the world, even the Islamic world, they don't say they have the Code of Justinian, but they follow these principles. There is no jury, by the way, in Islam. That should tell the story. If you don't have a jury, you're under the principles of the law of the city, but the rest of the world, they don't have a serious battle before the jury. They instead conduct inquisitions. Inquisitions. You've maybe heard of the Spanish Inquisition. And what do you do at an Inquisition? Well, you have somebody that's in charge of the Inquisition. It's not a trial, not at all. You're not trying to prove anything. A trial is where you try to prove something. You put it on trial. Well, they don't do that. They have an Inquisition, and somebody's administering the Inquisition. They call them tribunals. Sometimes we call them courts, but they aren't. It's just that the fellow they call a judge, we call him a judge, the magistrate, whatever you call him, he's just there to make sure that the code is obeyed and that they get the right result. That's all that matters. The powerful party must prevail, because the powerful party, even though they don't admit it in most of the country, or many of the countries of the world, some of them they do, in North Korea they do, they admit that the government is God, and they worship the symbolic head of that government, and it's the only public worship that is allowed in North Korea, just as it used to be in Japan. Somebody asked a while ago about, if you're Japanese, do the rights under our Constitution apply? And, of course, John gave a good explanation of all that and said, well, of course, you're a member of Adam's race, it applies. Well, and I want to get to that. I don't want to forget it. The reason I said that was so I wouldn't forget it. But battle by trial before the jury follows the same rules at common law, the same rules that men used to follow in common law countries when they had trial by battle. Battle by trial before the jury has replaced trial by battle, but the rules are strikingly the same. Matter of fact, we've just transferred those rules from one to the other. It used to be in Old England, if men had a dispute over land rights, then one of them would send the other one, if they couldn't agree, one of them would send the other one a notice, just like we do when we open a case here in America. And they would have this notice served. And just like today in America, you couldn't deliver your own notice. If you want to file a case against somebody in America, you can't go deliver you can't serve the process, as we say, that piece of paper called process. So what does that piece of paper fundamentally say? Well, it apprises the other party of the dispute, and it tells the time and the place where he must be if he wants to challenge it. Well, when they used to have trial by battle, that's what they did. They would have somebody else carry the challenge to the other fellow and say, I'm going to be at this certain place at a certain time, and I'm going to be armed, and you show up armed, and we'll decide at the battle, by battle, we'll decide who has the best rights to this piece of real estate. It was usually over real estate, because that's all there was that really amounted to wealth, because everything we have, and this is still true, of course, everything we have, every bit of wealth we have comes from the land. That's why we call it the law of the land, by the way. That's where property comes from, fundamentally. Well, they would send a notice, and if the other party didn't show up at that time, at that place, and defend his rights, well, he was in default. Well, the same thing's true in America. You put somebody on notice, you've sued them, you send the process server to serve process on him, and he can, and by the way, process has to be personally served. You have to hand it to him, and if he doesn't grab it, then you can throw it at his feet, and some of you have probably experienced that, but you have to do it personally. If you don't see him, he's not served. And the reason for that is, notice is so important and was so important in trial by battle when men would wage war with each other, personal combat. Sometimes they called it trial by combat. But if you didn't make the challenge personally, real estate was so important, land was so important, that you couldn't lose your land unless you were personally served. That way, the judge of the matter would know that you were on notice, and if you didn't show up, it wasn't because you didn't know. That's not fair. You see, that violates fundamental fairness to challenge somebody to battle, or as men later said, a duel, and the other fellow not show up because he had not been properly served. By the way, all of this, the vestige of all this, came to America in what we call the duel. And the duel was a very important part of American life. In a lot of places, it was slowly outlawed in different states. But the rules were the same there, too. Or you'd send a challenge to another fellow. If you're going to challenge him to a duel, you'd send it by, not yourself. You couldn't deliver it. It didn't count. The other fellow had to. Your friend or somebody, you had to get to deliver it. I'm going to be at so-and-so places, and I'm going to have two pistols. And here's the rules of the duel, and if you wish to defend your honor, you can be there. I have friends that still send out letters like that. I suppose I've done it too. You sue the other fellow, or there's a hearing. Let's say it's a hearing. And a letter goes out, or an email, however it's acceptable to do in your particular jurisdiction. And it says, I will be at so-and-so court on so-and-so date at so-and-so time before judge so-and-so or any other judge that may be assigned to hear the motion for a motion or hearing on a motion. And if you wish to be there and argue against me, here's the time and the place. Well, that's the rules fundamentally, and there's a lot more to it than that, of course. But all of those rules from trial by battle were transferred. And then with trial by battle, when men would challenge each other, they discovered that it wasn't always fair. What if an old widow woman who was very elderly was losing her land to somebody who was trying to squat on it and steal it, who was very powerful? Well, she couldn't realistically, if she challenged him, she couldn't show up. It wouldn't be fair for her to show up with her lance and her horse. She's 85 years old. It'd be obvious who'd win that one. So the practice began that people who didn't feel like they could survive such a thing and have a fair fight, a fight had to be fair. You see, that's part of our common law. We call it a fair fight, fair and substantial justice. And it's fundamental fairness that drives our courts. And that's what we call, by the way, due process. What is due process? It is our law of the land. And all these things I'm describing to you are all about how it is to be done. And if we follow the how and are very careful about doing it the right way so there is fundamental fairness, then the best case will win. And that's another saying of our common law tradition. May the best man win. What that means is may the man with the best case, the most merits, win. Well, that's fundamentally where our process has come from in our courts. But to bring it back to the question about the Japanese person, fundamental fairness, just a story, which was mentioned early on, Gerard, reading from his commentaries. In those commentaries, just a story says this concerning fundamental rights. He says that fundamental rights are not only for American citizens. That was no part of our understanding of common law. He said fundamental rights apply anywhere and against to any person where the government of the United States chooses to act. I believe those were his very words. These rights, these fundamental rights, there are some of them enumerated in our Bill of Rights enumerates them, but there are others that our Bill of Rights does not mention, and our courts have recognized those also because our Constitution says in the Bill of Rights that this Bill of Rights is not an exclusive list. It's not a list that it ends all lists. And if there are other rights that arise, nothing that is said in this Constitution is to disparage those other rights. And there are others that our courts have recognized, such as the right to travel, the right to get married, the right to have children. Those are all fundamental rights because they go back to the fundamental trust settlement of God with our grandpa, Adam. The fundamental trust settlement, be fruitful, multiply, and cover the earth. Well, you can't cover the earth if you don't have a right to travel. You can't cover the earth if you're unjustly jailed. You can't cover the earth if you don't have a right to marry. You can't cover the earth if you don't have a right to have children. You see, all of these fundamental rights tie right back to that fundamental trust settlement with God that God made with mankind through our grandpa Adam. Well, back to this question about a Japanese person, not American citizen. Do the fundamental rights apply to him? Well, yes, anywhere the government of the United States chooses to act, and of course our Constitution is first and foremost to limit the general government, as our forebears used to say, the general government sitting in Washington, D.C. If the general government sitting in Washington, D.C. sends the Marine Corps to the other side of the world and the Army, and they set up prisons in Gitmo Bay, Guantanamo Bay, down in Cuba, or in Afghanistan, and people say, well, these people are prisoners of war, they're not American citizens, therefore the Constitution doesn't apply, we can torture them. I am appalled, I'm aghast, that Americans in government and out in courts don't seem to grasp that idea. You can't do that. These are men. They may be enemies. They may have put themselves in a position where it's kill or be killed, and Americans kill them. But the Bible says honor all men. Even in battle, you honor them. You respect them because they're made out of God's holy imagination. And they may be evil at heart. They may be murderous. They may be child molesters. They may deserve to die under the law of God, capital punishment. But even in that, you don't disrespect them and you don't torture them. You don't do that because God, in his revelation of his will to man, has never given men permission to torture each other. And so the fundamental rights in our Constitution, and according to Justice Story, and he's revealing the mind of our common law. If there was anybody in our country that was committed to our common law, he certainly was. Now, there may have been other men, I know there were, I've read them too, that were as committed as he was. But none any more committed than him. Now, he, in my humble studied opinion, said things that I don't agree with. But I'll say this about Joe Story. He was right-headed. I like that word, right-headed. He was headed in the same direction I'm headed. And on the same path I'm on, I'm behind him, I come later. I doubt if I'll ever know as much as he knows, but I do think that he's fundamentally of the same point of view. He said, Justice Joseph Story served longer on the Supreme Court of the United States than anyone else. And he said there never has been a time that Christianity did not lie at the foundation of our common law. And I believe that that's a studied opinion, and I haven't found anything to contradict that. Going back as far as Beowulf, I see vestiges even in that old saga, that old poem. Clearly, they were aware of the revelation of God, the Bible, as we understand it. You can see it in the characters and the things that are mentioned. But Joseph Story, the other fellow that was mentioned today, and I want to plug his name in here too, it's coming to me now, Justice James Wilson. Gerard quoted him a while ago. He also was committed to our common law. And he said, our common law, I'm quoting, our common law is of origin divine. In other words, it's the revelation of God's will to men, unwritten, in the nature of things. And the common law courts have said that for centuries, and they still, once in a while, make those comments. I just finished adding to what people call the winterized version of the Bible, some of them were put in different places, 500 references of American courts from mostly about World War II up to about the year 2000. Well, not quite that far, but about 500 references to the Bible in our American courts, federal courts, and all 50 of the state courts. Some of them are very powerful. I don't remember one of those that disparaged the Bible. Don't remember one. I remember many of them quoting the Bible to support the position that the court had taken. Sometimes to chide or scold the parties before the court, either one of them or both of them. And it was refreshing for me to see that the courts in America still give credence to the Bible. As one court said, this has to be the greatest law book ever written. And it is a law book in this sense. It reveals the way things are, and they're not going to change. If there's anything the Bible does, it does that. So Japanese people, back to the subject, Japanese people or Afghan people, anybody in the United States, whether they're within, if they're where the government of the United States has chosen to act, then they're entitled to have their fundamental rights, fundamental being the rights, the duties, the discernment duties, responsibilities that God has delegated direct to the individual. Government has no jurisdiction to get between a man and his lawgiver, his God, who has given him those responsibilities called fundamental rights. So that would be the easy answer to that question, but as simple as that may seem to some, it bears repeating over and over and over again, because courts, I won't say they go mad, we used to say they go haywire. And I've tried to untangle haywire out of a hay bale. It's quite, it could take you all day, even if you've got a set of clippers and try to clip it out. Once it gets wound up in there, well, that's what our courts are doing. They're haywire. And they say things that are utterly, absurdly lawless, as these courts have said about D.J. Trump banning certain people from certain places coming into the country. He had statutes to cover himself. He was doing it pursuant to legislation of Congress. And the courts came along and said, you can't do that. Well, the courts are independent, I understand. And I want to, but when they're independent like that, they don't need to be obeyed. We obey them even when they're wrong as much as we can. I understand. We should do that. Don't get me wrong. I didn't want to overstate that. Jesus Christ even makes those kind of things clear in the Sermon on the Mount. By Roman law, you were to carry, if a Roman soldier asked you, you were to help him carry a load up to a Roman mile. That was what the law required if he needed your help. Jesus Christ said, if he asked you to carry it one, carry it two. Why? Well, because doing that you were not in violation of the law of God. That's why. If government asks you to do something and the very act of it is an act of violation of the law of God, that's different. But if the government asks you to do something and you're doing it does not force you to disobey the will of God, the law of God, as some say, then there's nothing wrong with that. And that's the way we learn to get along. We've got to give a little to the other fellow, and it's sometimes that's even government. But in our day, government has gone too far on that point, and we can cite the examples, and that's why it's important that we try to stick to law as much as we possibly can, because if we don't, government will soon enough get out of hand. I wanted to mention, just briefly, if I can find my glasses. Anybody see my glasses laying around here? I was going to read something, but here they are, my spectacles. Ah! Sometimes they're on my face. I check there first. I want to read, just because I want to keep moving in what we were doing, just for 5 minutes or so. I want to stay with our Declaration of 76 and say a few words about it. We're in paragraph 2. That's where we left off last time. We're in paragraph 2, and it talks here about being tolerant. And that our Declaration of 76, of course, says that prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, just because their language offends you or they make a mistake or a series of mistakes. And it says accordingly here, I'm quoting, all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But then he has that famous line also with that famous word, but. That's the next word, B-U-T. That means disjunctive. I'm about to tell you something different than what I just said before. Mankind are tolerant. Yeah, we are by nature. We don't want to fight. Well, most people don't. I shouldn't say that. There are people that will fight at the drop of a hat. But in general, the sway among the public is they'd rather not right away. They don't want the trouble. They're too busy. But, he says, when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces the design to reduce them under absolute despotism. It is their right. And what is a right? He tells us here, it is their duty. That's what a right is, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. I want to add about this definition of a right. I want to tie this up a little tighter. He does define it here. A right is a duty. And the old Germanic word, Recht, means duty. And the Germanic speech has another word for what we would call one's, what we have come to understand a right to be. We've made it a selfish thing. My rights, what I want. Well, that's not what a right is. A right is that in ancient Germanic speech, and English, the Anglo-Saxon tongue, is an old Germanic tongue. And the word right, the way we spell it, is different than the way the Germans spell it, but it's close. There's a lot of German words like that. They say mutter, we say mother. They say Vater, we say father. They say Gott, we say God. Our speech is very much Germanic, fundamentally. And the word right, or as we say right, historically, anciently, and even here, has always been a duty. We've hackneyed the word, and it has lost its fundamental meaning, popular meaning in most minds, unfortunately. And the fundamental right is something that's given direct from God with no intermediary party. But he says it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Now here our declaration provides a four-part test for recognizing when one must no longer tolerate government abuse. Number one, the first part of the test that must be met, and all four must be met. The first part is, in hindsight, the abuses and usurpations must form a long train, one after another. A train. Like a locomotive with cars behind it, one right after the other. But these individual cars of this train, he calls abuses and usurpations. Abuses are just what people think abuses are normally. It means that somebody's mistreating you, violating your rights, trying to get between you and your God so you can't do your duty. That's what a right is, again. That's an abuse. Taking unjustly, without due process of law, life, liberty, or property, or a combination of those. All you have in this life, in this age, here on earth, all you have and all you'll ever have here is life, liberty, and property. And for government to take those without due process of law is a violation of God's understanding of his creation, and our understanding should be his. He has given us property so that we can use it to his glory. He has given us duties with that property so that we can use it to his glory. He has given us life so that we can glorify him and using our liberty with our property. Now, life, liberty, and property, those three things, that's what can be, with respect to men, is the abuses come against those. Those three things rise and fall together. Take down one, lose one, or block from using one, enjoying one, and you will be blocked from enjoying the others. Because our rights are in our property. And we have property in our rights. And life is property because we have a right to life. We have a duty to use it the way the lawgiver, the Creator, our Creator, told us to use it to His dignity and not our own. Well, that's what abuse is. A usurpation is a use of power without authority. A use of power without authority. I was once a military man, and we were called away to, we were in the south part of the Pacific, and we were called away, or the southeast part, and we were called away to the northeast part, Korea, because there was an incident there. And so we, and the old man told us, he got on the box, I won't say what we called it, it's not nice and polite company, but he got on the box and he said, we're going to go up to Korea, and he said, we're going to, he said, we're going to fly the flag and flex our muscles. Try to scare them back into position, I suppose. Well, that's important. That's why we were out there. We were, but he made this point, and it stuck with me. I was a very young fellow at the time, but it stuck with me all these years. He didn't say flex our muscles and fly the flag. He said, boys, we're going to fly the flag and flex our muscles. You see, the flag represents the authority of the United States. It's the symbol. It is the symbol and was our symbol then of our authority to exercise power. Now, we weren't going to just exercise power right away. We were going to say, we have authority. Here's the flag. And second, we're going to flex our muscles. We were going to demonstrate, show that we had power and we weren't afraid to use it, I suppose, is the idea. There's a difference between authority and power. Authority cannot be usurped. It's impossible to usurp authority. Either you have it or you don't. But you can usurp power. If a police officer takes his gun and indiscriminately shoots people that make him mad, he has usurped power. Because he has power in his holster, that's a powerful tool. It has a chamber pressure of upwards of 50,000 pounds per square inch. That's what an M16 used to be anyway. That's a lot of pressure. That's a lot of power. And if he uses that power without jurisdiction, without authority, he is a usurper. That's what that word means. What was Britain doing? Well, they were abusing people. But how were they really abusing them? By usurping power. Using power without authority. Authority comes first in America. Right justifies might. In the rest of the world, the law of the city, might justifies right. I don't exaggerate when I say that. That's the way people think in Russia. I talk to them. It's just the opposite in a common law country like ours. We say, quo warranto, quo warranto. The courts aren't doing what they're supposed to do. File a writ or file a petition for a writ quo warranto. By what authority are you doing what you're doing? If you have no authority, you're usurping power. Stop doing it. Well, let me read through these real quick. We'll quit, and then we'll expound them, unfold them, unpack them maybe a little next time. The first one is our abuses, usurpations that must form a long train, one right after another. Number two, this train must be headed for absolute despotism. We'll talk about what despotism is next time, Lord willing. Very important to understand that. Number three, this train must show no wandering from its heading. That's why our Declaration of 76 says, pursuing invariably toward despotism. And number four, this train of abuses and usurpations must show a design to reduce the people under absolute despotism. That's the goal. Our Declaration teaches that once the government fulfills all four of these, it is a people's right, it is a people's duty to end their responsibility to that government. I'll end with this. I said this last time. No place in our Declaration of 76 do you see a call to arms. That's important because the Declaration sets forth the standard, but it's not quick to go to battle, and nobody should be quick to go to battle. Why? That's just the last resort. People could get killed. injured, maimed, all the other ugly things. I noticed that the left wants to fight. They want, they're violent, and they've proven it. A fellow from Belleville shot a congressman. I just thinking the other day, I ran for Congress once. I don't know that I'd want to run again. And I don't want to take a chance of getting shot. I've got other responsibilities I want to fill. Well, that's enough for today, John. Gerard, again, thank you. And the things that I've said here may or may not be necessarily the views of NLA, but they're mine. They're kind enough to let me put mine across. Back to you, John or Gerard, whoever's there.
Thank you, Brent. Appreciate that. I just wanted to say one thing. You know, when the court challenged Donald Trump on the statute he put out, I think he knew right then and there that they didn't have the authority to do it, that he could have ignored them. But I think he let it go because he wanted to keep them busy while he was doing all the other stuff he was doing. He knew, look, a good lawyer knows he's going to win a case before he takes it, right?
Yes, I agree.
And I think he understood that he that they weren't going to win that, but he let it play out anyway because I think it was a strategy move. That's my opinion for whatever it's worth. So, anyway.
I tend to think that, too, and I think it worked out good. I'm glad it happened the way
it did. I do. And look, at right now, timing is perfect, too, for this to come through. It's all falling into God's timing, you know? So, anyway, we got Jan. Why don't you go ahead? We got Paul from Michigan has a question, and he can't get in the queue. So we're going to go ahead and unmute him first before I start on the queue. Go ahead.
You're unmuted, Paul. Go ahead. Paul, are you there? I see you come up. We can't hear you. Michigan Paul, ends in 3331, telephone number. Are you still with us? I'll mute you and then unmute you.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, good. Go ahead. What was your comment or question?
I didn't have any.
Oh, I thought Robert said you had something you wanted to say tonight.
Well, yeah, Robert, but I thought we were going to talk with somebody on Friday, so I was going to save it till then. The question, I guess, one question would be is when the sheriff arrests somebody under the common law, where does the defendant go from there? After the arrest, after the defendant is tried by the grand jury and by the petite jury, is that considered sufficient to send him to behind bars for a while or what?
Well, certainly, if everything was done according to due process, in other words, according to fairness, according to his fundamental rights, and his fundamental rights weren't violated, but if his fundamental rights were violated, if he was arrested without a warrant, if he was forced or tricked into confession, and there's a whole lot of rules that go with that, if his house or his effects or papers, his automobile, his van, his truck were searched without a warrant, if evidence was obtained wrongfully, if evidence was planted, if the jury was stacked, the grand jury or the petit jury, or I'm just giving a short, I mean, there could be hundreds of things because due process, as our courts have repeatedly said and still say, is unknown. What is required, really, until the need arises. There may be a situation that arises that a different element must be inserted to ensure fairness. Now, we know what some of those are. We know what a lot of them are. We know what maybe hundreds of them are. But there's always a situation that bobs forth from the flux of human relationships we've never seen before. And if we don't make some adjustments and say, wait a minute, if we apply the old standard here, this certainly isn't fair. And so due process is known in its doing. It's only known in a real case in controversy, and if a fella is convicted, with due process being followed, then he can suffer the penalty. Now, I personally, and this is my personal conviction, but I wouldn't say it if I didn't think it was true. I don't think jail's justified for anything. I don't think God justifies throwing people in cages. I don't find that in the Bible. I don't find it in nature. It's evil. The evil empire has been filled with such things. I do know that and think it's right that men can be held awaiting trial. The Bible even gives us examples of that under the law of God. But to jail people is quite another matter. That's downright cruel. That's cruel and unusual. And by the way, it's a violation of God's fundamental trust settlement, which I mentioned a while ago.
That's why the jury is supposed to make the sentence, too. You know, you get the judges with these mandatory sentences. Under common law, there should be no mandatory sentences for anything.
Well, no, but that's right. I agree, of course. Go ahead, Troy. You're going to say something else?
I think that's why you get a better sentence when you have a jury handing the sentence out, because the whole idea is to restore the injured party. Look at order him to work for them or do something to restore whatever it was that he did to take somebody's fundamental rights away.
Uh-huh. Property, right, son.
Right. Yes, we have more sense than putting them behind bars and letting the taxpayers pay for nothing.
Right. Destroy his family, take him away from his children, destroy his wife, destroy his parents, discourage the community. It's uglier than, man, is it up. Jails are ugly. They're evil. They're wrong. I can't say that strong enough, and I've known hundreds of men that have been in jail.
All right. Okay. I hope we answered your question there, Paul.
I got another one, too. I met with a sheriff last week. He says, I can arrest anybody anytime. I mean, for good reason. What do I do with them then? Where do I go with them? That was a big question.
I'm sorry. I didn't understand your question. Did you ask a question?
Well, yeah. You know, once an individual is arrested by the sheriff, generally speaking, of course, the court needs to be notified, and a hearing has to take place, and that's the process.
But that's what I figured. But the sheriff, he was concerned about that because he's really getting interested into this. So,
right. Well, look, all he needs to do is find an injured individual in a criminal act. Okay, and it really becomes that simple. I mean, look at if someone comes and files a charge with the sheriff and fills out an affidavit. Hey, this guy punched me in the nose, or whatever the case may be. You know, right there, the sheriff has to go and make the arrest, and the process needs to go forward. I mean, prosecutor needs to look at that particular case and has to be taken before the grand jury. The sheriff can go directly to the grand jury. I mean, look at with the way things are today and what we're trying to set up, once we get grand jury administrations going, and, you know, the sheriff could just go to the administrators and say, hey, I'd like to talk with the grand jury, and give him an appointment, let him go. Put his case before the grand jury, get his indictment, and it's over. It's done. And then, of course, now the process of justice in the courts will take place. But, you know, look, if it's not an emergency that the sheriff needs to go out and arrest someone right away, maybe that's the case. He does his, investigation and brings it to the grand jury and asks for an indictment.
Well, really, the sheriff's not supposed to hold them any longer than it takes to get the indictment and set the bail. That's the whole idea. And then, you know, then there's a time between the indictment and the trial where he would work out his defense. There's no reason.
I don't think the sheriff should take it to the prosecutor. I don't think it's the prosecutor's job in that case to take it to the grand jury. I think all sheriffs should have access to the grand jury and be able to get put onto, onto the schedule and to meet the grand jury in the next time it's meeting and give him his case. I mean, why even go to a prosecutor? Now, again, you know, if someone shot someone and killed someone, you know, they have to be apprehended and, of course, held in jail until we can go through the due process. But look at, you know, if someone is accused of something and then they are convicted and then the penalty or the requirement is to restore the individual somehow, which is what needs to really be done, that is the key to justice, is to bring that person back to him or his or her original state of being. But once that process takes place, if there is a concern that that person may flee, especially in today's society with all the electronics and stuff, they can put a ring on the person's leg and tell them you can't leave the city limits or whatever the limits they put forward for this individual. And so they can control him without having this individual go to jail and thereby require the restoration of the injured party. So that's kind of picking up on an earlier question, just to add a little more.
Mm-hmm. So let's just say once now this year just arrest someone, and, of course, the courts are corrupt. Even the grand juries are corrupt today.
The grand juries are tainted. The prosecutor will come in and twist the grand jury's arm, so to speak, to get the whatever conclusion he wants to get out of them. A sheriff does not have to go to a prosecutor or to the court itself. The sheriff can go directly to, and he should, I think that's the way it should be going, directly to the grand jury. Now, all he's got to do is go into the courts and call for one, and you know what? If he really feels it's corrupt, then all he has to do is walk into the court and let them know, I'm going to be meeting with the grand jury today. I need a room, and have the sheriff's office just dial people up and have them come down to hear a case. I mean, if it's that corrupt, that's what they could do. But, of course, this is what we're trying to stop and prevent. Right now, to get to a grand jury, even by a sheriff, is almost impossible. You can't get audience to the grand jury because they don't want you to, not without their control on it. But that's why we're looking to take it away from these individuals, because you can't let the fox take care of the hen house, you know. The people need to control the people's business. So we need to be the administrators. We're not to have any political ties that would, put us to this position or that position in a particular case. And people and the sheriff and anybody, everybody and anybody, should have access to the grand jury. If someone wants to come and talk to the grand jury, they need to be put onto the schedule and let them talk. And see, if they can convince the grand jury of an indictment or something, then that's fine. That's the way it should be, anyway.
Isn't that denying our constitutional right when we cannot go before a grand jury and defend the case?
Yeah, well, remember, constitutional rights is not a good way to say it. It's an unalienable right protected by the Constitution, maybe, you know? But,
God-given.
Yeah, we have an unalienable right of access to justice.
Right.
We have an unalienable right of access to justice. We have an unalienable right to go speak to our grand jury. We have that right. If we want to talk with them, then audience must be given. Of course, they won't give it to you. But we need to get it to that point where it happens that way. Anybody can bring a case. Any of the people can do an investigation. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 people can come together and start investigating and go down and talk with the grand jury about what they've discovered and give their evidence. And it's up to the grand jury to, you know, complete that investigation if necessary or make a decision. You know, that's why we're putting the administrations together, because they would be the investigative body for the grand jury. And if the grand jury themselves wanted to go and look at books in an office or something, then they, you know, the administration can set up the process and open up that avenue for them to go and investigate on whatever they want to do. Look into computers, look into books, talk to people, ask questions, anything they want. That's the purpose of the grand jury, to figure out what's going on, see if there's someone needs to be restored. And generally it all starts off with an injured party. And usually that's easy to see, that an individual comes forward in an affidavit and say, I've been injured, and this is how I've been injured, and I need to be restored. This is what I'd like to be restored to, but it's up to the trial jury to finalize that. Or the grand jury it doesn't have to go to court. You know, anything, if the grand jury can get in between and work out an arrangement for restitution to restore that individual and both parties agree, case is over and settled. And that will be held, to be fulfilled.
Okay. Thank you very much for your answers.
All right.
Okay, you're all right.
Yeah, I had to unmute myself there. All right, we'll start with the first of the queue. I don't know who this is, but it's 2149, and then there's no name. So go ahead. You've been unmuted. Give us your name and your state, maybe.
Hey, what's up, John? Hey, John. I mean, Gerard. This is Jeremiah from Northern California. Hello, Brett. Hello.
Hi.
Mr. John Darash. Hello. But hey, I guess I don't have a question. I've been sitting, listening, enjoying the conversation. If I had to ask a question, I would ask it based on something I had two police officers tell me once. And what that was as they had me in the back of their police car, and I was claiming it was common law that I was under. They proceeded to take me to the hospital and told me which one, and I didn't have an answer for them. When I got there, I was able to get out of the involuntary detention, the 72-hour one, within 2 hours of being there, and 10 minutes after submitting a demand for $30,000 an hour, you know, while they were making a legal determination, let alone all the other rights on the wall. But the point I'm trying to make is the cop told me which common law, you know, and it was interesting that he said that I couldn't respond. What would you say if you were in the same situation, Brett or Gerard or anyone, and you said it's common law and the cop says which one, how do I respond to that?
Well, there's only one country, and that's the common law under the Constitution. The Constitution and Bill of Rights are common law documents. I don't know what he's talking about, which when, because in England maybe there's two common laws, but not in America.
Well, there is a process that the courts claim that the collective decisions of the court is the common law. That's what they call it. Of course, that's not the truth per se. Of course, if the court, any decision of the United States Supreme Court that is not repugnant to the Constitution can be used as evidence of a proper understanding of something, you know, whatever the court might be talking about. But I'm not sure. Look, first of all, when you talk to police officers about the common law, they have no clue what you're talking about anyway. Now, maybe this guy did have an understanding. And if he did have an understanding, I can only imagine he means, are you talking about natural law or the common law through the conclusions of the federal courts? I mean, that's probably what he's talking about if he understood it. But I wouldn't even bring it up to the officer because, you bring it into the courts and you deal with it there. The cop or, you know, the arresting officer has no understanding what's going on. Of course, we need to educate these people. We need to bring it to the point where they are. They do have an understanding of the process, and they are able to respect our rights. Right now, they have no idea what our rights really are. They violate our rights every day. And every time they stop someone, they're violating someone's right, unless they have cause, and often they don't have cause. But anyway, it's not worth arguing with a police officer.
Right.
Let him do what he wants to do. Got to do and then deal with it in the court.
Right. You know what I like to do instead of dealing with it in the courts is carry an attitude of forgiveness with me. And in this way, really, I don't have to go into court on some ill, for vendetta or something. You know, I can check myself, really, if you think of it that in those terms. That's the best advice that I could give. You know, when it comes to dealing with it, just depends, I guess, how bad the injury is. And then if you're talking injury, that common law right there is actually commercial. And now you're talking damages. So, I mean, it's a whole, you know, there is layers to this republic, right? And what I thought interesting was I've been in touch with someone named Charles recently and on TalkShoe, and he has a constitutional republic kind of conference call. And on it, I was able to kind of get confirmation with regard to the people being, you know, a separate part of the government, not the state. You know, for a long time, I thought the people were actually the actual state representatives. But in fact, I think you know what I'm saying. There is a confusion, and there's an overlaying, like hologram, yeah, of federal power over every single state. But there's also this other layer that people never see, and that is the true de jure republic, which actually all offices are currently vacant for the most part. And I believe that I haven't met anyone, but I believe I've met people that want to fill those offices. What do you say, men?
Oh, I wanted to say that if you get arrested and you tell the cop you're under the common law, that's like saying to him, well, I follow the law of the Bible. That just make him mad, confuse him, and he'd say, what Bible? Whose interpretation? You start talking like that, and that's going to upset people. Get judges same way. They're not going to know the difference, and it'll make them mad. People who study common law study what we call comparative law. You don't study common law because the common law is not known except in comparison and contrast to its great antagonist, the law of the land, that is known by comparing it and contrasting it with the law of the city. And so there have been volumes written, I've read some of them, and there have been people who have argued about how to define our common law. One of the people that I admire is William Franklin Fratcher. He's gone now, but he has tried to define it. He's gone, but Charles Rounds, he's still alive back in Suffolk Law School, and he has tried to define the common law. He gives about four definitions just to show, a short definition, but just to show that people don't agree on what it is. And that's the way our common law is from start to finish. It's confusing. The words overlap. There's nothing more confusing to the civil law world than the common law. And even to us that live here in America and we live with it, if we tried to explain it, we couldn't. And even those that spend their lives studying it can't agree on a definition. Well, why is that? It's odd, isn't it? But the law of the city is perfectly logical, they say. It has perfect elegance, perfect balance. Everything is corresponding. And when we go to our inquisitions, we have total order. Now, there's nothing more disorderly on the face of the planet than a common law trial. Oh, the judge tries to keep it in check. I've seen, boy, have I seen some wild, crazy things in court. And it's confusing. But why is that? Well, it's because it's a fight, for crying out loud. It is battle. It is battle by trial. Before the jury or before the judge, and people will push the limits. It's just like going into a boxing match. Of course, when you go into a boxing match these days, they follow the Queensbury rules. And hard blows are permitted, but not foul blows. But when you tell men that they can deliver hard blows, but not foul ones, inevitably there's going to be some foul blows, because in the heat of battle, the blood gets up, and people say and do a lot of things they would not otherwise say and do. Well, that's what happens in trial. You know, it's why lawyers are held in contempt sometimes, justifiably. Unlike the fellow out in Oregon that got tased, the lawyer that got tased all those times, Mumford, that wasn't justifiable. But there are times, and I've seen it, where and judges get upset and do things they would not otherwise do. I've seen judges throw things at people in court, throw things at lawyers. And if lawyers are wise, as long as they don't get injured, they'll just brush it off and go on. Because that's what happens when there's a fight. But to talk about the common law, it's messy is what I'm saying. Judges can't agree on what it is. And worse than that, judges and lawyers are no longer taught that there's a difference between the law of the land and the law of the city. In other words, comparative law is not a required course in our law schools anymore. It used to be. It is in some few schools offered, but not very many because there aren't any comparative lawyers left, aren't there, at all. And when I mentioned William Franklin Pratcher, he was one of the last of the few. This fellow I mentioned, this Rounds, he, I don't think he teaches comparative law because the school doesn't allow him to teach it. Well, if you can't teach comparative law, you can't teach the difference between the evil empire and the kingdom of God, the law of the land and the law of the city. And without that, you'll never know what our common law is. Our common law is only known by its contrast to the evil empire, the law of the city. And so to talk to a cop, or that's worse, he would know less than a judge. And when he said, this cop said, he said, which one? I don't know, but I suspect he's probably gone through a training course, and he's taught how to handle people that say things like that. I know judges are. Judges are educated after they become judges at the Judicial Council at the University of Nevada in Reno, Nevada. And they go there for free. And there are private donors that fund it. They're not Christian men. And they, by doing so, they teach judges how to handle patriots in court. They teach them what to say, what to watch for. They teach them what the buzzwords that people use, like common law, that mean that they're crazy. They might shoot somebody. There are other words, of course. Homeschoolers, they're targeted. Folks that are Christian fundamentalists, Bible believers, and people that talk about common law. So if you mention that, what you're bringing to yourself, you're casting pearls before swine. They're going to trample the pearls into the mud and turn and rip you to shreds, to flinders. There's no sense saying those kind of things to judges or police officers. There is something to be said, though, for defending your rights, and there's a time and a place to do that. Now, if a police officer is not personally injuring you, it's better just to let him take his course and process what he's taught to do, and then seek your remedy, your redress in the courts according to due process and according to the law. If you try to resist a police officer, you're going to get hurt. I had a police officer tell me the other day, I hired him on for a security job, and he retired, big fellow, about 6.5 feet tall, nice fellow, teddy bear kind of a personality. But, of course, he was a police officer, and he arrested a lot of people, and he got into a lot of scrapes, and he told me that people sometimes used to say to him, when he'd say, well, I've got to arrest you, they'd say, well, you're not arresting me. And, of course, he'd say, now, look, I don't want to fight with you, and maybe you'll get the best of me. Because he said he'd had that happen a few times. You never know who can get you now. But he said in every case, even when they got me down, even when I was out of commission, I'd tell them while they were trying to get me down, if you get me down, somebody else is coming. They're going to get you sooner or later. Well, that's true with a police officer. So as long as he's not hurting you, and of course, if a man's trying to kill you unjustly, that's different. And there have been cases on the books where men have defended themselves from police officers that were using an unjust force, and they were acquitted of a crime. I read recently about a fellow down in Texas. They busted into his house, and he was sitting on the bed. He reached over. He didn't know who was in the house. There was no knock, no announce, as our law traditionally requires, a common law. And he picked up a pistol laying beside him and shot the first police officer that busted into the room, killed him. And he was tried for murder and acquitted. That happened not more than 6 months ago. I forget, something like that. I saw the whole case on the Internet. There are those rare cases. And a man needs to be ready for the worst. If a police officer goes mad and crazy and starts killing people, that's happened in the past, then something must be done to stop that kind of madness. But that doesn't happen very often. As a general rule, it's better to seek your redress in court. They'll throw you in jail, keep you there at night, do what you can to get out, do what you can to get a hold of a lawyer, do what you can to get a hold of your family. But it's best to seek due process. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. One last thing before I go, I will mute out after this and yield the mic. But thank you for answering the question here. One sentence from Revelations 14:8 presumes to say, and there followed another angel saying, Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of the fornication. And I think that is a great piece of, dialogue to for me to part with, because it sums up basically, quite a bit for a lot of people, you know, and I appreciate it. Thank you to the Bible. Thank God. Thank you, John, and all you guys. Thanks, Gerard.
Okay, Jeremiah. Thank you. We got California Fred.
Yes, Gerard, I'm here.
Go ahead.
My question was from last week, and it's for our common lawyer friend.
Uh-huh.
Do you remember, sir, what I asked?
I remember, Fred, that you asked, and I remember we talked, but I don't remember the question exactly. No, I don't.
Oh, well, it was about reading what the judge's response was to the paperwork.
Uh-huh.
And coming up with what can we do in our paperwork to, like, perfect it so they have to address it and quit ignoring it.
And did I respond last time? I don't want to repeat myself. More than that, I don't want to contradict myself. Did I respond last time to that question? Do you remember?
Well, no, because you at that point had not read the judge's
response. Now I do remember. I do remember that. And all three of you said, well, Brent, we hope you can read this. And I haven't read it. And I don't think I got it. I'll ask one of you to send it to me if you would. Not right now. You don't have to, but I'll make a formal request. Somebody
so
send
this
it.
Will leapfrog into next week, maybe. But
well,
sir,
maybe,
my question was really that they're ignoring our paperwork, and I can kind of understand it because we have this judge that just arbitrarily comes in and, well, this was brought to my attention, you know, and then he throws it out of court, but. But I think it's more subtle than that. I think this judge that did that is probably involved some way in some other cases that John and Gerard have mentioned. And I think a thorough investigation of this judge is in order. And I wouldn't just pass it off as some random happenstance. There are a lot of people that know about NLA and our struggle. We've been documenting and sending paperwork to every congressman, every senator, every judge. My God, they all know what we're trying to do, and they're doing everything they can to prevent us from prevailing.
Well, I'm sure that's true. That's why I felt it was
imperative that you maybe go through the paperwork and see if you can discover any flaws that can be patched up. Like, I don't even know if they're using a Bates stamp on their documents.
No. There's no magic. Look, the flaw was in the judge, Fred. It wasn't in us. It's in him.
Well, you know what a Bates stamp is, don't you?
A who? I'm sorry.
A Bates stamp.
A Bates stamp? No, what's that?
B-A-T-E-S stamp. Every time you push it down, it puts out a number, and it keeps all your documents in a numbered sequential order. It's a means of knowing how many documents in each filing, and for each case, you have a consecutive number from the very first cover sheet page to the service, right on through to the very last page. And that way you can account for all the pages in the documents that's submitted and filed and helps you do your paperwork tracking. I'm sure Mr. Winters can inform you about all of that. It's essential that you do it. That's just my opinion. I'll yield out and let you gentlemen talk.
Well, the base stamps that I'm familiar with that are used in the courts are used for evidence more than anything else. But if you're just filing papers, evidence is important to keep it in sequential order, and everybody knows what it is, and they'll use a Bates stamp stamper. So Bates stamp's just it's that little stamper that you roll the numbers around on it, the dates or whatever, and give it a whack on the paper. I think the fellow's name was Bates that invented it back 100 and some years ago. Very popular and still used, amazingly.
Excuse me, sir, Mr. Winters.
Yeah.
This is a grand jury.
Uh-huh.
Submitting information that is evidence of other cases where there's a miscarriage of justice. Everything they are submitting is evidence, sir.
Well, then it's Bates stamp. That's what you're saying, right?
That's why I brought it up, because I figured you could. I'm not trying to be a hostile. I'm just trying to bring out an obvious thing that I can perceive as a problem.
Well, if you're going to submit evidence, it'd be nice if it was bait stamp. If it isn't, the grand jury or somebody else can do it. But if you do it for them, then it's not a problem. But there's no mystery to it. It just means there's a stamp on it that from 1 to 9,999, page 852, 853, 854, 855. Just stamp it that way, and it helps them keep it in sequential order and keep things ordered up a little bit. It is important to do it. I agree with you. But as far as the paperwork, the bait stamp's nice. As far as the paperwork goes, it sounds like that. How, I can't say. I don't know until I read. Can one of you do one of you fellows have those comments of that judge? I wanted to kind of read what they were. You got me interested last time, and then I kind of shelved it in my mind. I didn't think about it, but the way you fellows talked about it, this judge said some pretty outlandish things. I was hoping to read it.
Well, I think it's posted, Brett. I think it's on the docket.
Oh, okay. I got you.
His decision in order. I think he called it a decision or something like that.
Okay.
He out of left field, so he kind of, you know, he turned our nice little boxing match into a tag team wrestling show or something, and jumped in the ring. So, and look, we gave him a writ of error, and the next step we were talking about tonight is we're going to indict him. So look, there's going to be no mistake about what he did and why it was done or what he needs to do, because I'm sure they're not used to this ever happening, but it's happening, and they're going to have to deal with it. And it's happening in public. It's happening on this show right now in front of, I don't know how many thousand people. So we're on record in more ways than one with this judge. And the more this gets out there and the more people talk about it, and we're going to put it in the NLA news, this guy should be embarrassed. And that's why I wanted to dissect his words when I said to John, look, he used certain terminology. I've been asked to look at this. Well, wait a minute. What do you mean you've been asked to look at this? That's an ex parte conversation. We didn't have anything. What are they doing, writing you letters, asking you to come? You're not even the magistrate in the case. You know, we're here 6 months. Who are you? You know, you're coming out of nowhere, and you've been asked to look at it? We have no knowledge of anybody asking you anything. You know, I mean, judges are supposed to be pulled out of a pool. All of a sudden, you come. We got this magistrate that's sitting there silent, hasn't said anything, being a good little boy, except for he's got to sign the default of the clerk. He still has some time left, not much though, and he hasn't said anything, hasn't raised his head or anything. And then this guy comes in and throws the whole case out. Who does such stuff? Who puts up with such stuff? You know, he's not dealing with a bunch of people that don't know what they're doing, or a bunch of ranchers from out west that they think that they own or whatever. You know, that whole business of what they're doing to the ranchers just exacerbates, and this proves what they're doing to everybody. Everything they've done since the beginning of this case, all their knee-jerk reaction, all their missteps is on file, and our answers to that are on file. They can't take this stuff out. This is a case. This has to go down on the books forever. You know, we filed a case that we lost, and you know what? They've quoted us on one of our cases with the Board of Elections or something. Even though they dismissed our case, we lost it or whatever they did at the time they ruled against us, that case is still on file, and they've actually quoted it for some of their stuff that they wanted to use it for. So we're doing the right thing. NLA is doing the right thing. And whether they think they can ignore us or not, see, what they're doing is their crimes are now being done in the light. And he's going to realize it in a real short order. I don't think he thought through what he was doing. I think they said get rid of these people. I think it was another knee-jerk panic reaction when he realized that the clerk thing was sitting there for over a month and it's coming. It's coming right, the default, and then the default on the gun case, and they probably said, "Oh my goodness, we've got two defaults here. What are you going to?" Well, I'll dismiss it. because it was a knee-jerk reaction. I don't think he thought it through, and that's usually what happens when you break the law, when you're a criminal and you don't think things through. He's used to getting away with this stuff, but he's not going to this time, is he? And now that he's got our paperwork, I'm sure there's a cold, icy feeling running down the back of his neck right now because he has to deal with we the people, and he doesn't want to. You know, and so he said, well, you're an association. You're this. You need an attorney. You can't come in here. He lets us sit. We've been in there for 6 months. We said, look, we laid the law of the case out. We laid out who we were. We laid out that we're coming in as the grand jury, as surrogates of the peace, and the only reason we paid money is because it's the only way to get in the court today, because you're all corrupt, and we need to, and you shouldn't be charging us money to reveal these crimes. And there was nothing from the court. And they gave us a magistrate just like we asked for. And then 6 months later, he dismisses the case and he says, you need an attorney? I mean, if that doesn't show a dysfunctional court system, I don't know what does. You know?
Well, Gerard, maybe if you could say, I'm on the website, and maybe other people want to look at it too, what's the quickest way to get to that document? Hello?
I'm sorry, I had muted myself when I was done. Let me just see if I can find it, being that I said that it was there. Let's see.
Well, I'm ramming around here, but I don't know where to go exactly.
Let's see, it should be. Oh, why does that do that? Docket. MR case. The case comes up. Let's see here.
Do we start with, go ahead.
It's going to be down on the bottom because you see the last ones there are, let's see, second letter to Attorney General Jess Session. Hang on, brief. Hearing is a strange. What are the dates here? Free information to President. Treason or writ of error. Well, writ of error. Click on the second one from the bottom, the writ of error. It might be included in that. Hang on. I don't know if John included the judge's response in the writ of error. He might have. And if he didn't, let's see. There's six pages here. Writ of error has, let's see, genius of the court of record. Hang on. Yeah, but you know what? His response, his decision and order isn't in here, and I guess it should be, and I guess we just didn't post it yet.
Okay. Then I'll wait to get it posted.
I know I have it. I could drop it to you, Brent.
Well, but either way, yeah.
Because it's interesting to see. Let's see, writ of error in our order. Hang on a second here. Oh, here it is, the treason order, the next one up.
Oh, okay.
Plaintiff grand jury summons. Defendants include, among others, United States Congress. Oh, yeah, this is the judge's paper. This is what he sent us.
Okay.
And you'll see here, order dismissed without prejudice. Yeah, this is it here. So he starts
okay,
out.
Okay, I got it. I got it.
Grand jury, sovereigns of the court, in this action, blah, blah, blah. Defendants include other things, United States Congress, President of the United States, blah, blah, blah. Governors of all 50 states, dockets completed. The complaint is over 100 pages long and contains a laundry list of grievances. Of course, he wants to make it seem ridiculous. Alleged violations of the United States Constitution to take just one section of the complaint is dedicated to the showing of the balance of power set up by the Constitution was laid to waste by unratified, unconstitutional 17th Amendment. Okay, so he had to pick that to pick on, right? And as several defendants point out in their brief of support, their motion to dismiss, the defendants point out the complaint is essentially a political manifesto. So that's what the governors and everything are calling it, a political manifesto. File an order to show cause against the clerk of the court, Lawrence K. Berman, on January 19th, demanding that Berman show cause by what authority the clerk may charge for justices by requiring the filing for docket fee, order show cause, blah, blah, blah. Plaintiff moved for default judgment against Berman, asking the court to order Berman to return the plaintiff $400 filing fee immediately, docket number 16, motion for default judgment. And on June 12th, the court received several letters from plaintiff on behalf of individuals seeking relief from allegedly unlawful non-judicial foreclosures, i.e. docket. I don't know what he's calling letters. We must have sent memorandums of law in. According to the complaint, the plaintiff is comprised of 50 grand juries, each unified among the counties within their respective states. All 50 states have unified. So he goes through who we are, and he says the complaint is signed at various points by grand jury foreman, that is to say 279, and no lawyer appeared on behalf of the plaintiff, whose address is listed as P.O. Box, blah, blah, Valhalla, New York. On April 19th, the federal defendants in this case asked the court to dismiss this case on the grounds that the plaintiff is apparently unincorporated organization, cannot proceed without counsel, docket number 17, letter motion, docket number 17, letter motion, which we never received. What's a letter motion? Is that something that's normal?
I don't know.
A letter to the judge that they ruled on. So instead of giving opportunity to respond to it, right, individuals are permitted to represent themselves in a federal court, but the statute does not permit non-attorneys to represent another person or any other artificial entities. So basically, that's the grounds he threw it out for, was the fact that we're not attorneys. Partnership.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. But, when I looked at it, I'm looking at it now, read it through it quickly. What bottom line, it's not lawful, and it never has been lawful for a non-attorney to represent an association, partnership, or a corporate entity. And he's saying, as far as I can tell, this is an association of people in L.A., and if they're an association, then they've got to have a licensed lawyer that I accept in my court. And that's why then he cites the statute that says that, and then the cases that have ruled consistent with the statute. And I understand what he's saying. And it's not because you're not lawyers; it's because you're presenting yourself as a corporate body, even though you're not incorporated. And
Well, that's not what we presented ourselves as. We gave him the law of the case. We did not file the case under National Liberty Alliance. We filed the case under Sureties of the Peace, the grand jury coming into the court under an extraordinary problem in order to let the court know that there's a problem.
Yeah.
Right?
We are not
an association. We are not a group. We are not. We went through all that terminology, because if he thought that's what we were, they should have brought up the objection 6 months ago.
Yeah, he didn't know what to do, because he'd never faced something like this. And he couldn't find – I'll bet he'd talked to a lot of other federal judges all over the country, because they stay in touch. That here I got this case of, who are these people? Are they a corporation? Or are they – what are they? And so they talked about it, and then they said, how can we get rid of this case? Well, he didn't really get rid of it. He said that – you have 30 days, it's not with prejudice, so you have 30 days to refile, represented by a lawyer. And I think he goes through here someplace and says that the foreman of the grand jury, he didn't have any indication he was a lawyer either. Otherwise, he would have Let It Continue. I saw that someplace here.
Yeah.
You saw that, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
This is fascinating to him, I'm sure. Go ahead.
Well, and then in response to this, we gave him a writ of error saying, who are you? What are you doing in our case? What is all this communication going on? Right? He's attacking our procedure and our process and who we are, and we're coming back and attacking his process, his procedure, and who he is.
Plaintiff is comprised of 50 grand juries, he's quoting, each unified amongst the counties with the respective states. All 50 states have unified nationality as an assembly of thousands of people, he's quoting the complaint. The complaint is signed at various points by the grand jury foreman, and he tells the pages, but no lawyers appeared on behalf of plaintiff, whose address is listed as Vahalia. Federal defense in this case asked the court to dismiss on the ground the plaintiff, as an apparently unincorporated organization, cannot proceed without counsel. Letter motion. And you didn't receive that letter motion at all, or the NLA didn't receive it?
I never saw it.
Yeah, that's not fair if they don't. Everybody who files a paper in the court is supposed to make sure all parties that are concerned have the paper also. Apparently you didn't get it. And I've never heard of a letter motion. I've never used one. I don't know what that means. I'll have to try to look it up. I don't know. It's obviously not something that occurs very often. Go ahead.
They did the same thing to me in our case. The attorney went to the judge with a letter motion, never sent us a copy of anything, just asked the judge to do something, and they called it a letter motion. I called it a letter motion.
Yeah, ex parte. That's what I'd say, too, if you didn't hear about it. But he keeps going over the idea that he says under 28 U.S.C. 1654, individuals are permitted to represent themselves in federal court. And, of course, that goes clear back to the Judiciary Act of 1789, if I remember right. But he says the statute does not permit non-attorneys to represent another person or any artificial entities, including corporations, partnerships, or associations. So it extends, the right to represent yourself extends to all natural persons, but not to non-natural persons, such as corporations, partnerships, LLCs, etc. And he's taken it that's what he has in front of him, or he says he believes that anyway. Can you still hear me, Gerard? Am I still talking?
Yeah,
okay. I want to make sure I'm still here. So the only options are to either have a lawyer represent the organization that he perceives and come into court and say no, or come into court and say, no, this is not my organization. This is an individual or two or three individuals, whatever the mistake may be. He's construing it that way in order to make it hard and get rid of it, because that's the job of, on the other hand, that's the job of a federal judge. The federal courts are courts of limited jurisdiction. The state courts are courts, practically speaking, of unlimited jurisdiction. The state court can hear anything. It can hear federal matters, state matters, constitutional matters, unless Congress says otherwise. But a federal court is a court of limited jurisdiction, and it is the culture of the federal courts to try to get rid of as much litigation as they can and throw it back to the states. So if they can find a way out of this, that's what they're going to do. And that's part of the limited jurisdiction, the whole culture of the limited jurisdiction of the federal court. Of course, sometimes they go too far. I've seen that happen lots of times. But you brought an action against this clerk. Go ahead, Gerard.
Sounds like this is something we should discuss after the thing as far as strategy goes. Do we bring up one person and call ourselves the people, or do we get an attorney to represent us? I mean, this is something we need to discuss. I mean, it's almost a no-brainer place for him to go, because he's quoting our own words against us, so it makes it hard to put the idea forward that, look, this is the people doing an extraordinary action as the grand jury assembled at arm's length from the court, and you can't tell us how to assemble and how to come in. I would quote U.S. versus right back at him. Look at it. We're the people. sending in, call it an indictment then. How about that?
Uh-huh.
And I'm letting you know that there's crimes, and so now if you don't do something, now you're a criminal, right? But you understand where I'm going here. But we don't want to give them something that looks so square when they're looking for round that they can't handle it at all, right?
Yeah, this judge is not a young boy. He born in 1937. That's a long time ago now. But he was appointed by Bill Clinton back in 96.
Yeah.
So he's a Democrat. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I think that he was considered a constitutional expert or something. I think he's a judge that got his judgeship by helping Robert Schultz in a state court action when he was a New York State judge. And then he got his, Bob Schultz was running state constitutional violations of the state through court, and this judge kind of helped him out and brought his case forward and used it as a springboard for him to get into the federal court as a judge that knew the Constitution, that was a defender of the Constitution, this guy. Of course, they gave him to us in the beginning, I think, and then we had asked for a magistrate, so then they gave us this magistrate. Right.
Oh, well, yeah, there, I see what, so Judge, is Judge Kahn is not the magistrate, is he? He's the judge.
No, he's the judge, and they gave us this other guy, and then all of a sudden Kahn comes in and says, I'm dismissing the case, blah, blah, blah. They didn't give us any notice or anything. This guy says, we were asked to by the defendants in the case. Well, if the defendants in the case were asking to be dismissed, we should have received notice of that so that we could answer that.
Yeah, that makes sense, too. Judge Kahn used to be a Republican. He was a Democrat. The Democrats wouldn't appoint him to a judge. He was from Albany, and so he turned Republican, switched parties. He used to be the corporate counsel for the city of Albany, apparently. This guy, and he was on the New York Supreme Court. Now, that's no small potatoes back. That's a big, big court.
Yeah,
court. Always has been. Go ahead.
And Robert Schultz, We the People, was bringing constitutional cases in New York State Court, and this judge helped him out at what a case he was doing, because he needed a constitutional case because he was vying for the federal judgeship, and Robert Schultz says, I helped get him in the federal court with Mike. Help me with. So it's just an interesting story, that's all. But anyway.
Okay. Yeah, he's an interesting character. I was just reading about him here. Go ahead.
Anyway, we should probably discuss our strategy offline, and I'll move to some different people here for their questions.
Okay.
But
okay,
it is interesting. I'm sure some people are interested in this because it's important. I mean, this is what we're doing, and this is how we figure things out, right?
Uh-huh.
Fred, are you done, Fred? I still have you open. I want to get to the next guy here.
Yes, sir. Mr. Winters, thank you very much. We are so in sore need of getting to these people. Maybe it's getting a hold of a special prosecutor at the Attorney General's office and having one of them assigned to take the case and then drag in the 2,400 other prosecutors.
Well, we have to. We did ask him for that. We did ask him for a prosecutor, whether they're going to. We asked Sessions, we asked Trump, and I don't know if you'll ever get this.
Where in your paperwork did you ask for one from that magistrate to produce him?
Well, I don't think we asked him this particular.
Demand it. You're the grand jury. You've got an indictment. You want to talk to a prosecutor. Demand it.
That's a good idea. We'll do that. I think that's a great idea.
You guys discuss strategies. I'm going to get off the line. There's other people with questions. I don't want to hog the whole time, sir. Thank you very much, Mr. Winters.
My pleasure. Talk to you.
Very good. Okay, the next caller.
Hello, how are you?
Yes, who's this?
Kristen from Michigan.
Hey, Kristen, what's going on tonight?
Real quick, I had a couple of things. I hope I can cover it in time. One, I quiet titled a property that I owned, and Bank of America was the servicer, the assumed servicer, but the mortgage company had went out of business. And when I discovered that, I quiet titled it, and I got a judge to sign off on it and everything. Then I took Bank of America to court, federal court, on a fair debt collection case, albeit it was a kangaroo court at the time because I didn't know about court of records. And, of course, the judge did not allow my case to go through. Now Bank of America is trying to foreclose on my quiet title property. And I was just wondering, they're playing shenanigans, but I shouldn't stipulate to the fact that they're foreclosing because they're using art of paper to intimidate me into a foreclosure. And the only reason I'm having to maybe pay for it is because it's my mother's property. She's 90, and she'll just die if she loses this property that was free and clear. I'm just wondering, in your non-judicial foreclosure, this is being done by the sheriff's department when I called down to the city to find out where they're supposedly holding this auction. And the clerk said that the sheriffs are doing it. And I said, well, where's the judge involved? Well, the judge don't do it. We do it all day long with the sheriffs. So how do I go about making an affidavit when the documentation is not clear-cut? They're playing, like I said, art of words and documentation to harass me.
In order for the sheriff to sell it, that means it's already been processed. In other words, they've converted the deed or they've done something in REM or something. There had to be some kind of proceeding that the sheriff can't just foreclose on a property. He needs permission from the court. So
it's all fraud. So they can do whatever they want. They can wave the magic wand and make whatever happen because, again, I have a judge signature making the mortgage a false lien title, but they're claiming that mortgage was assigned, and it makes no sense. It just makes no sense whatsoever. Again, they're just fabricating all of this, and, of course, they put the property on Zillow.
You need to object and challenge the paper that they put in there that the sheriff's operating under. Look, I think the best thing for you to do is go ahead and fill out the affidavit under foreclosure. We have forms, and you'll see it when you go in there and fill that out.
Right, I heard about that.
Yeah, and get that paperwork going so at least you can notify the sheriff. We had a woman here that took our paperwork, and they stopped the sheriff's sale with it. So we know that it at least works for that. Now, of course, you're going to have to keep proceeding. They're not going to stop for long. They're going to look for ways around it. Like you said, you've already quiet titled it, and they're not honoring it, which is that's a whole other issue right there, you know, because you have a clear title that they have to somehow, they got to run through some kind of proceedings to pierce that. And if they haven't pierced that, then you are the owner, and they are not. They don't have a right to take it.
They have the guns. They've done this to me. I've gotten two other properties taken from me this way, where they have no rights, but they come with their guns and their police officers. So what can I do? I'm not going to shoot a police officer, so I have to give up the property.
When we send the sheriff a paper that there's an action going on, he has no desire to violate that because you're taking an action in a higher court, and he's not going to do anything that the court doesn't tell him what to do. I don't even if he's corrupt, it doesn't matter because he's at that point now his skin is on the line. You can sue him even if they take your property and they sell it to somebody else, and the sheriff had received a piece of paper that said this sale should be stopped. This thing is in controversy. It's in court. You know, I have an injunction or whatever it is that you have, he can no longer sell that piece of property until that issue is taken care of. They stopped Frieda's thing right in mid-sale. They took it off the day before the sheriff's sale, and the county had already transferred the deed into their name the way they like to do in this in-rem non-judicial foreclosure that they use. But the paperwork that we put in was enough for them to stop that. So what I'm telling you is just go and fill out that paperwork that we give and at least do that until you figure out what you're going to do with the title. I don't know all the minutiae of the quiet title and all the other stuff you did, and I know there's a lot of fraud in there that they play because they're so good at it, but your main thing is you need time right now to figure out what your strategy is going to be, and of course you can't do that if they're evicting you out of your house, can they? Can you?
Well, I don't know if they're evicting. I have a tenant in there. They're claiming that I have 12 months redemption period to their felonious loan. So I'm not sure what they're going to do. I just can't afford to lose it for my mom.
Right, right. So this thing has a couple more layers than a normal foreclosure. So what they're trying to do is attach that mortgage back into the deed, I suppose. Right?
But if I pay it, they're going to alter everything. They're going to put a title commitment in there. They're going to it's just crazy. I'm being forced to pay something, and then that's just going to agree to their shenanigans, and they're going to claim that it was a revised mortgage and draw me in that way, even though it's based on fraud.
Well, you don't pay it like that. The only way you pay it is in a settlement where it's to the terms that you write in there. You could pay it.
I can't. But I'm going to have to pay it because they're going to come with their guns.
What I'm saying is you can settle with them for less money. But, you know, that's not what they want. They probably want the property and they want the mortgage. What I'm saying is I wouldn't pay anything that they give you to pay because you're consenting. You're absolutely right. So if you're going to pay anything, make sure it's a payment on a settlement to your terms that says that it's dismissed with prejudice. They can't come back, and they're accepting these terms as a settlement of the action. That's it.
See, they have the upper hand at this point because they have an auction date already set, and unless I pay it, they're intimidating me without. Into doing it. So
what are they telling you? You got 12 years to redeem. I mean, you got 12 months to redeem after the sale, as they're saying?
And that's an art of words because, again, they're making all this stuff up and they're putting these things out and they're attaching it to my property, but they're not putting the right legal description on it. So I'm being forced to do it because if I don't, the police are going to come with their guns like they did before.
Yeah, you have to move it out of that. You have to get it into an upper court. You have to bring it into the federal court.
Okay, and so I'll just have to sue it. I'll pay it, and then I'll just go ahead and do a trespass on my fair debt. Okay, now real quick, the other thing, too, is the post office address. I'm learning that the post office is involved in this as well. It's on various levels. And when they kick you out of your house and they no longer allow you to get mail, they claim that the property is vacant and they can't deliver mail to a vacant property. How does the post office fit into this from your experience? Do you know?
I don't know. I just know that people that do common law and stuff, they don't like post offices for that reason because it sucks them into that whole fiction. But, you know, and they have a habit, even with tax sales, they do whatever fits them best. Like, they'll evict you from the property, and then they'll send the last notice to the last known address, which is the property they evicted you from, full well knowing that you won't get it. So they do deliver mail to unoccupied properties. I know that for a fact. They send it to the address of no. Now, if they evict you from the property and you want to make sure you get mail, you just give them go out and take a post office box that they can forward it to, so that you're getting any mail that would come to that property. And they have to forward it for quite some time. I don't know what it is, 8, 10, 12 months. You know what I'm saying? If the mail is going to be a problem, there's no reason that you shouldn't get your mail. If your property's vacant, look at it, I can leave my house vacant. I'm going down to a different state, and the post office will forward me that mail in the new state that I'm in for as long as, you know, I tell them to. So that should not be an issue, is what I'm saying.
Okay, so they do play into that role then, because it's all made up. And then one last thing, are you familiar with 5 USC, where the government collects information on you and they have to provide you with certain information as to why they're collecting your Social Security number? They have to tell you whether it's mandatory or voluntary, what statute by Congress passed that law to collect your information. Are you familiar with that at all?
I am. I used to have what they call the public servants questionnaire, where they're trying to get information. You say, well, before I give you that information, the law says you have to answer this, which is what you said. What are you using it for? Who's it going to? And all that stuff. Is that what you're talking about?
Right, because I want to use that with the driver's license, because they're not telling you why they're under what authority they're asking for your Social Security number and things of that nature. Has anyone ever tried that with their driver's license at all?
Not that I know of. I mean, I can't say if they have or they haven't. I haven't heard.
Okay.
I mean, what's it hurt to try, right?
Right. Yeah, I was going to write to the Secretary of State and find out to see if it's mandatory or voluntary, because they're supposed to give you a documentation that tells you all, because the I-9 form is the perfect example of the 5 USC. It tells you by what authority they're asking for it, whether it was mandatory or voluntary. It has all the things that are the prerequisites for the government collecting that information on you. And I was just wondering if anyone in your experience has ever used that with a driver's license before.
I don't know, but, you know, now that you mention it, I may get some letters or something. That's why it's good to mention things on the call, like on the Monday night call, because I don't know everything, far from it, and we have other people that are more adept in other areas such as that, maybe. So maybe we'll get some responses, you know.
Okay. And one last thing, too. I've often had, when I was doing the kangaroo courts and the judges ran circles around me, I would then file a report with the judicial counsel against the judge, and the clerks never forwarded the paperwork properly according to statute. And so I was just wondering, as a way of another strategy for you guys, is to perhaps bring in the clerk for impeding justice for not processing a complaint against a federal judge. If you're having problems with the judge.
There's got to be redress for every injury. There has to be a remedy, right? If she's supposed to be the, she's not processing stuff right. Oh my goodness, there's probably U.S. code on that.
Right, and they often send it out with a signature that's not an original signature, and court documents have to have original signatures when they're responding, unless you consent otherwise. And a lot of times they don't do that, and people fail to realize that.
Well, let me ask you something. Did you confront the clerk about this?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. And again, my time, I've thrown a couple of things out, and they're supposed to respond. If not, you can actually sue the government if the government doesn't do their investigation within 30 days, because now they're sanctioning that person's malfeasance, if you will. So I have not gotten to the point, to the part where I'm actually suing the individual or the government just yet. Because I have a lot of things in the air. And as you said, there's a lot of grievances to take place, and I'm just trying to strategize things so I can put things in a proper perspective. So I have a footprint to go back and do it, because you can all, in time, never ends to the grievances that you can file.
I have any.
I have a spare key.
Right. I lost my train of thought. Yeah.
Well, I won't take up any more of your time. You've been helpful to me. I thank you for your efforts and what you're doing, and I'll yield to the next person.
Okay. Well, we're over time, so I'm going to close it down. But the reason I asked you if you confronted the clerk, you just want to make sure that it wasn't a honest mistake. If you asked her and she didn't fix it, well, then, you know, hit her with the full force of the law there. You know, and I'm sure that if she's doing stuff like that, there's U.S. code that covers that. And sometimes,
oh, yeah, it is. And, in fact, they sent my complaint back to me after I responded to them twice before. So they got nervous and just sent it back, and that's not what they're supposed to do. So, in essence, they didn't answer my question. So they were guilty for not answering, as you know.
Right.
If you don't answer, you're
guilty. Right. Well, just keep track of all that back and forth mail that's going back and forth, because that's all evidence.
Right.
Okay. Nice talking to you.
Okay,
sorry
take
we
care.
Get to everybody in the queue, but we'll try again next week. And, you know, we got a little long there with the judge's response, but it was interesting. So thank you everybody for coming, and we'll see you here same time, same station next week. God bless everybody, and keep your powder dry and your ink flowing. Have a good night.
Thank
God
you.
Bless.
Bye-bye.
Hey, Jordan. Bye.
Thanks, Brett.